might have to say the Doctor Who mega set.
For me, I guess it's got to be the Scream Factory releases.
The hell are you guys doing?
Just talking about some of the home release stuff that we're thankful for this year.
What about you, Luke? Which Blu-ray releases are you thankful for this year?
All of them.
And beer?
Oh yeah, definitely beer.
Happy Thanksgiving, TV turkeys. Welcome to the 21st episode of Digital Noise right here on oneofus.net. Yes.
Hey, we can drink now.
Our show is old enough to drink and drink as much as we are.
Wow.
We have.
I feel like such jailbait.
Right? We've just been stringing along this underage show, hoping and praying that would reach maturity before the cops found out we were doing it.
I mean, mature. What? No, of course this is my first beer, officer. Ossifer.
Ostrich.
Ocelot.
Well, anyway.
He remembers me!
I'm sorry I had to be gone for 2 weeks. I hope you guys don't mind that there was no show, because obviously there couldn't be a Digital Noise episode without me here. So thanks you guys for being able to take a break like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to really recognize that, like, you know, how you guys to really show me in that way how important I really am to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, come here, let me show you how important you are.
We definitely didn't do shows with a fill-in co-host.
Yeah, wait a minute. Shouldn't this be show 19?
Well, anyway, this is the Blu-ray DVD review show stuffed with fun and dressed with puns. That's right. That is a sentence I just spoke. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, Google Gobble. I am joined by the human equivalent of meat and potatoes, that is Luke Mullen.
Hey, that's me.
That is you. And you may have heard that rounding out our group back after his short stint abroad is the geo-gorging globetrotter, Christopher Lawrence Cox.
It didn't feel short.
How long was I gone?
2 weeks in like a that far away feels like they should make a movie about my experiences.
Yeah?
Yeah.
2 weeks.
It was like 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Felt like Tom Hanks in Castaway, only with more Asian people.
Slightly more Asian people than you will find in the movie Castaway.
And skyscrapers. There were not a lot of skyscrapers in Castaway, generally speaking.
No.
Maybe in the beginning and end, but not so much in the middle.
Yeah. No, that's very true. But so do you have anything to declare?
That's what they asked me at the airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I bought every fucking Hayao Miyazaki little gadgety thing I could find.
Yeah.
Which, sadly, you don't really care about.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I'm glad you found stuff that amuses you.
Yeah, I very much did. That. I looked, because the other thing was the J-horror thing. I was like, I gotta find cool, or superhero shirts with Japanese characters on them.
Something.
Nothing. None of that shit. Every time I went to a place with stuff like that, it was just the American t-shirts that had been, were probably made there in the first place.
Yeah.
But we're clearly the same.
The tag says made here.
Yeah, exactly.
Made over there.
Yeah, both China and Japan. But you know what? It was a lot of fun. I got to tour Shaw Brothers Studio.
Oh.
Which, unfortunately, was a huge letdown because
what?
There was nothing in it.
Oh.
It was like they moved out of the old original studio like years ago, which is now just a business office, and they didn't keep any of their props or pictures or anything. So the new studio is just this big mega studio.
See, it's funny, too, because people have been finding Shawscope 35 reels in the weirdest places all over the world. So I bet if you know, while the tour guide wasn't looking, if you just started kicking boards up from underneath the floor, you probably would have found a whole mess, a whole stash of unreleased Shaw Brothers.
Sadly,
movies.
Not in this place. This was, like I said, the brand new studio they had just built.
Just
and like they were like, we were at like, oh, this is our biggest lot. And it's this 20,000 square foot place. I was like, cool. So it's empty. He's like, yeah, if you got here 2 days ago, you would have seen the Transformers 4 sets.
I was like, oh, shit.
Seriously?
Don't tell me that. That's just me.
I don't even care about the Transformers movies, but that would probably have been pretty cool to see.
True story.
Yeah.
Well, we are going to help ourselves to a heaping portion of listener interaction by slicing open
the letter box.
You've got mail.
That's right, the letter box with the gravy and the biscuits. Our first question comes from Blair Regenvetter. I will always, from now on, eternally mispronounce someone's name who submits a question. And this week, it is Blair Regenwetter. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that.
It's got to be, right? Your parents couldn't possibly have kept that last name.
No way.
Okay.
So the question is, what character from a TV show, movie, or possibly a comedian would you pick as the most influential when it comes to your sense of humor? He says that his would be Honeycutt from MASH.
Or hers.
Or Blair. Yeah. I guess Blair could be a female. I apologize.
I would think more likely even, but it's hard to tell.
I will always mess something up when it comes to the names.
We love you anyway, Brian.
Yes, well.
Bry guy. Oh. You know, it's funny, he or she listed Honeycutt from MASH, and I always, in my head somewhere, picture Alan Alda from MASH, Hawkeye, but... You know, I know I'm not as funny as Hawkeye.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about answering this question is, like, at no point in referencing somebody who has influenced us in our sense of humor are we in any way saying that we are as funny as that person.
I mean, probably, like, it's not even an actor. It's really just, like, Monty Python's Flying Circus, the television series, was the single biggest influence on developing my sense of humor.
Right.
You know, I mean, that absurdness, hidden... You know, trying to hide the actual message underneath the absurd humor, that sort of thing, you know. Yeah, am I representative of it day to day? No, definitely not.
You do a lot of funny walks.
That's true. But that's usually because I have an organ failing.
Oh, alcohol, we love you so much. Luke, what about you?
Well, I could be really mean and steal Brian's because I know what it is.
Go for it.
No, it's all right, I won't.
Is it Joey from Friends?
No, it's Chandler Joey from Friends.
It is Chandler from Friends.
Jeez, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
No, it's the greatest thing ever.
Could it be any sadder?
Hooray! Because Chandler is amazing.
That's true.
No, if I'm completely honest, it's probably Eddie Murphy. I think I was in 7th grade when I first heard Delirious.
Man,
Delirious and Caddyshack were... two of the three VHS tapes that we watched until they were just snow.
What do I feel this is all put on? Luke, I'm not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe again.
Wait, what? I'm so confused.
It's
Beverly Hills Cop. Come on.
No, just the stand-up. I never saw Beverly Hills Cop.
You've never seen Beverly Hills Cop?
I have never seen Beverly Hills
Cop. Brian!
Dude, don't even get me started on the things from the 80s that Luke hasn't seen.
Oh,
we've been working on it. It's like we're getting a recovering heroin addict back on his feet. I mean, we're slowly but surely getting him back into
civilized world. Have you at least seen 48 Hours?
Nope.
Oh, no.
But Eddie Murphy's stand-up,
but
on the other hand.
That's the thing. Is like Luke, when he says there were only two VHS in his house, he means it. There was the stand-up, there was the Eddie Murphy stand-up, and there was Caddyshack, and that was it. So, like, some bizarre old boy project for 20 years, all he had to watch were these two VHS tapes that he memorized and watched over and over and over again.
This question was actually extremely easy for him to answer. Then,
yes.
It's like, that's all we were allowed in the cave.
For me, I've always kind of thought of myself as a mixture between Chandler Bing from Friends and Dr. Cox from Scrubs. Because it's like, on the one hand, I do like to... zing people with and use stupid puns, but also every once in a while I can be a little bit caustic, I think, and not even like meaning to, it just kind of happens, and I'm just like, I am not going to listen to this story again. And then I do the little
thing. I'm trying to decide if he's self-aware enough to know that he's a dick, or
I was trying to be nice about it to myself for some reason. But,
I guess you've known him longer than me. Is it this a normal like delusion that he has that he's like those guys?
That he's like those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, he definitely takes. It is the perfect answer to the question.
Sure,
his sense of humor is definitely shaped by both of those characters.
Fair enough. Yes. Fair enough. I would have gone with Kermit the Frog, but
Kermit the Frog is definitely in there somewhere. although I'd have to have a banjo to show you the exact moment of influence
or
for Kermit the Frog.
Some impression comic,
yeah, absolutely. Probably
Kevin Pollak,
yeah, actually. I have a lot of respect for Kevin Pollak. Was one of the first celebrities I ever interviewed.
Really?
Yeah, way back in the day, I did a phone interview, and this is back when I had a day job, so I did it on my lunch break, and I had no idea how interviews work, so I literally was just writing down what he was saying to me as he was talking on the phone.
God, I was just taking a shot in the dark. Wow.
Kevin Pollak is definitely up there. He's one of the...
Really?
Yeah.
I live in Queens.
You have a team of monkeys working on this? Good question. Thank you, Mr. or Mrs. Blair.
Yes.
And moving...
Hand me the keys, you fucking cocksucker.
We also have a question from Zachary Landis, who asks, "Good evening, kings of the media landscape, and to you, loyal subject. I was wondering when is a good time to upgrade your HDTV? Also, what brands do you guys prefer? Keep up the amazing work. Well, the time to upgrade to an HDTV is a week ago last year, so definitely want to jump on that.
I think the best time, Zachary, and it's good that you've learned that flattery will get you everywhere. The best time to upgrade to a new HDTV is when you can afford it.
Yes, or when the one you have has ceased working.
Or a week ago last year.
Both excellent times. What happened a week ago last year?
I don't understand people that don't have HDTVs yet.
Oh, I see.
I don't get it.
Why don't you have one yet? Yeah. Well, he does say upgrade your HDTV.
Okay, I guess. Right. Yeah, I guess that's true.
I was actually just talking about this with someone who was saying, like, don't you think you're going to get a 3D TV at some point? I'm like, only if that's the only choice available, mm-hmm. I really don't need or want a 3D TV. And true. I'll say this, I am grateful they're out there because it's lowering the price on the regular HD TVs.
Yeah, you can kind of look at it the same way as you do like an iPhone. It's like, if you don't care about having the latest and greatest, then wait till the latest and greatest comes out and then buy the one that immediately preceded that.
Well, let me jump in here real quick and say, in relation to what Chris is saying, and also to answer the second half of this question, Panasonic plasmas are the best TV that money can buy. Or at least they were until about a week ago when Samsung put out the first OLED TV. But,
oh, Jesus.
Regardless, those are super, super expensive. So if you have like $15,000 to blow on a TV, then yes, you could get an OLED TV and it would be the best picture quality you could get. But for the rest of us, the best picture quality for mere mortals comes from plasmas. The best plasmas are made by Panasonic. Panasonic plasmas pretty much, I believe all of them do 3D now. And our friend Peter Hall actually got a new one last year. And it was kind of one of those things that's like, it has 3D. I'm not buying it for 3D. I'm buying it because it has the best 2D picture quality available on the market.
Word.
And then he got it home and I went over and we watched some 3D stuff on it. And I gotta say, 3D at home looks so much better than 3D in the movie theater. Like, I feel like if 3D in the movie theater looked like that, nobody would have a problem with 3D.
True.
It looks amazing.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I've seen some 3D TVs where I was like, yeah, this looks really real, but it just starts to give me a headache after a while. I'm like, why would
That's
I?
That's because I you're an old man.
Yeah, well, maybe so. The one place
That's because you're watching it on your lawn.
The only thing I'd be interested in is video games with 3D, which admittedly are really fucking cool. One of the things I saw in Hong Kong was a sit-down, like, sort of House of the Dead type shooter, except with a very Japanese mentality, so it was, like, all crazy fucking monsters and girls with long hair and shit that was in 3D. So you put on the glasses, and I was just watching the demo going, fuck! This is really freaky! So yes, I could see that, but, you know what, as far as, let's be very clear, as far as brands go, it's electronics. That shit changes by the month, as far as which single item is the best thing for any given thing. If you're getting ready to buy and you have the money to buy, just do your research. See what's going on. See what's available for less money. You know, obviously, I'm going to assume you, like most people, don't want to spend more money if you don't have to.
Sure.
See what's available, reasonable in your price range, that still comes highly recommended.
And for that, I recommend CNET reviews, reviews.cnet.com. They review the vast majority of television sets that come out, and they're very reliable. They've been around for a long time, and so I would highly recommend going there if you're looking for TV reviews. Don't look at Amazon customer reviews, please. No,
those people are idiots.
You got to research a little more than just some random guy who has an Amazon account.
Those people who don't know how to change the settings on their TV and therefore scream about the picture quality from a TV that just came off the floor.
Yeah, oh, also, if you are buying a new TV, please make sure that you find whatever your TV's True Motion setting is called and turn it off.
Yes.
And then break whatever knob allows you to turn it back on.
Why
immediately.
Is that still a thing?
Because of Peter Jackson, that's why.
No, it's like, it looks like, makes everything look like a soap opera. I don't understand it at all.
Yeah.
Why does anyone want
Brian's
that?
Brian's saying that it's similar to the high frame rate, 48 frames per second.
Holy shit, what a great segue, because the first title we're going to talk about today in the reviews is The Hobbit Extended Edition. And I do want to remind you that everything we talk about, you'll see those links right here on this post. If you click on that and get to Amazon, anything you buy supports the site. Hey, Christmas shopping. I know everybody's going to be doing a lot of holiday shopping. If you come here first and then go to Amazon, anything you buy for anyone on your wish list, that will support the site, and we really appreciate it.
Please do that.
Yeah, we thank you in advance. Arigato.
Arigato. Now, The Hobbit Extended Edition.
You know, speaking of that, let's be grateful that 4D TVs are not all the rage right now, because would probably be the only version Peter Jackson would let you have.
True story.
That version. Thankfully, we still have this normal 1080 version, and it looks glorious, much better than it did in the theater.
I can imagine so.
To sit down and watch the telenovela version of it. I'm sorry, it just looks awful.
And the worst part about that is that when they screened it for press, they randomly, like Shirley Jackson lottery style, put us in, some of us in the 48 FPS theater, and some of us in the regular frame rate theater.
Yeah, I got stuck in the 48.
It was like, we didn't have a choice. It was like, you go there, you go there, you go there. It was like, what, am I being loaded onto a train? What is happening
yeah,
here?
Yeah, I actually, several people asked to be moved to the other theater and were turned down. I said, nope, sorry. And I know several critics who just left 20 minutes into it. We're like, oh, you know what, I'll just pay to go see the regular version.
Really not, ridiculous. You know, it's really surprising this movie had so much backlash from critics. I don't know.
Well, yeah, you know, that's the whole thing, is like that whole demanding that this is the way you have to see it. It's like, I'm sorry, it's nice to have the option out there if you want to mess with new technology, but you shouldn't really force it on the people who are reviewing your movie. And I think that maybe this got a little harsher reviews than it should have on its initial round because of that. But that being said, this is, at least as far as I'm concerned, really the weakest of the four so far out Lord of the Rings films. And that has largely to do with the first reel of this, which is features mainly the most irritating people you can imagine taking over your house and messing it up for way too long. And sure enough, the extended edition, as we feared, considerably extends that portion of the film.
Well, this has been The Hobbit, the extended edition. All right, well, tell us more, I guess.
You know, the thing is, like, they're always in these, there are always bits that you're like, okay, that's really cool. I'm glad I got to see that. That's this added, extended scene, whole scene that's cool. And there are moments here that are like that, but not as many as with the previous ones. I mean, the previous edition, especially, I think it was The Two Towers, I think had the most amount of significantly extended sequences where, like, wow, that's a whole subplot that was cut out entirely about stuff. That's not as much here. It's more a little bit
I
here.
I believe it's only extended by like 12, 13 minutes or something.
It comes out to 183 minutes here this time. I'm not sure exactly how much more it is over, but it's not as much as some of the previous ones. Like, I think one of the previous ones was like
minutes.
One of the previous ones was like almost 40 minutes. This is like, okay. But all that being said, I do love The Hobbit. There's a lot to love about this movie. And this is the one that's got the special features you were hoping were going to come with the regular one.
But knowing full well that this thing was going to be chasing it on its heels.
Yeah, which is what they call the Appendices Part 7, A Long Expected Journey, which is a huge amount of extra featurettes about every little tiny feature on this thing. Now, it's also got the Appendices Part 8, Return to Middle-earth, a lot more stuff. It's missing... They want you to buy both, so this does not actually have I believe it's just the day-to-day director journal stuff that was on the
original
disc.
Oh, yeah,
that
stuff was wildly popular online.
Yeah, it was, but that was about it for the special features on the other edition of this. So you kind of have to have both if you want everything, which is another one of those, like, come on, guys.
I mean,
we
all know that once the third part is released, like, they're going to do the big set like they have for Lord of the
Rings.
That'll have everything that you could possibly
want. It's weird to me, though, to hear that this doesn't include those journals, when what it does include, apparently, is this weird argument on set between Andy Serkis and Ian McKellen that everybody made a big deal about, but even as you watch it, you're like, actually, it doesn't seem like they're really fighting. They're just having a tough time dealing with the special effects, but they're working it out. Like, I didn't really, like, everybody was like, oh my God, did you see Ian McKellen yelling at Andy Serkis? I was like, guys, stop it. Just quit it. You're trying to make controversy where there isn't controversy. And yet, it seems weird that they would, that Peter Jackson would be like, oh yeah, yeah, put that on the extended edition.
Yeah.
Not the other journal stuff, just this.
Yeah, this is of the two, is the one that's worth getting. I mean, the 14 minutes isn't long enough to significantly irritate you, even though the original theatrical cut, and this is the only thing you can say for any of the previous ones, the original theatrical cut is the better cut of the two. But this has got, by far, the wealth of the bonus features, so this is the one to get.
Also includes a quick shot of our friend Eric Vespi selling Bilbo a fish.
That is true. He was out there when they were filming, and he plays a Hobbit fishmonger. So, there you go.
Which is his new nickname.
Hobbit fishmonger. I think he already took the AIM screen name, Hobbit Fishmonger, because it was AIM and there was nobody else there.
HobbitFishmonger.com.
HobbitFishmonger.com.
@hotmail.com.
At geocities.com. All right, well, that was the Hobbit Extended Edition, and now I am so pleased to say that our next title we're going to discuss is The World's End!
Thank God.
The World's End! It's finally over! more?
I can't believe this day finally came, that we finally got the third piece of the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy, the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy.
Yay.
It was one of those that kept talking about it and pushing it off, and that by that I mean the first one was Shaun of the Dead, the second one was Hot Fuzz, and the third one is indeed this film, The World's End, which were all directed and written by Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, and starring Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. This one takes a lot of the, you know, as there's a lot of crossover characters through all this. So it's, this one brings Patty Considine, Martin Freeman, who he was just playing Frodo or Bilbo in The Hobbit, Eddie Marsan, who I love so much and doesn't get enough work, into it, along with a lot of other familiar faces. It is definitely the thematic wrap up of this thematic trilogy.
Such a fitting, fitting wrap up.
There's
to
no
all
direct connection between the films, other than a sort of underneath meta self awareness that it's part of one series, with very hard to catch even at points references to each other.
Yeah.
But yeah, a fitting end to me. This was probably the weakest of the three, but not by a big margin.
Oh, I loved this one.
Oh, I loved it too. I just, you know, it was my least favorite of the three films, but my God, still, how much better
is
this
than most?
Yeah,
that's
true.
I mean, we're talking about three great films. I mean, even being the bottom of the top is still a great thing to be. But what I loved so much about this movie is that, in order to make this point, I do need to say something that's kind of spoilery. So if you haven't seen The World's End, don't listen to this little spiel. But so much of what makes a body-snatching movie terrifying is the idea of losing your identity. And, you know, being assimilated and, you know, losing who you are. And I think the reason that it was chosen as the plot for this last movie is I think somewhere deep down, all three of these guys are recognizing that they're about to lose a major part of what made them who they are with audiences. They're about to move away from this trilogy and this, you know, this type of comedy. And I found it so poignant that, and then on top of that, you have Simon Pegg playing. I remember we got to interview him, and he said that he called his character Beetlejuice. Huh. Like, that's who he felt like he was playing, which is actually really interesting. But in spite of all that, you get to a point where you realize he actually has the most depth of any character he's played in this trilogy. And I was really surprised at how moved I was by his character and by what ultimately ended up being the wrap-up to this story and the ultimate wrap-up to the trilogy. So I was really, really impressed with it.
Huh. I was too. I thought, if anything, I had a problem was that there was too much of a front end of non-genre stuff. Now, they all have that to some extent, where it's like building the characters, getting to that point where the genre kicks in. Mm-hmm. It's just that it goes from this very steady, traditional sort of British drinking comedy that's moving at a very normal pace for that sort of film to 100 miles an hour in the space of seconds for the entire rest of the film, which is that whole genre thing, which happens somewhere near the beginning of the second act. Which is fine. It has a lot to do with my own personal expectations, certainly, going into it. I thought it was maybe stretched out longer than it needed to be, but ultimately I really enjoyed this. There's so many in-jokes that are there just for you folks who are fans of the series, but not jokes that you're going to go, what was that, and scratch your head. You would never know that that's what they were.
Yeah.
As well as, I love, one of my favorite things about the series is the way there's always a point in the film where something tells you everything that's going to happen with the whole rest of the film.
And
here's the point where they tell you what the names
of comedy breadcrumbs.
They tell you what the names of all the bars are, and every name of the bar signifies what's going to end up happening in that bar.
Yeah.
And since the last bar is called The World's End, well,
you can kind of guess what happens. But and that's the other thing that Edgar Wright does so well is he telegraphs things without you really knowing, and he does it by bookending jokes. Like, somebody will say something very innocuous at the beginning of the movie, and then you find out that it has a much more significant meaning later, even though you had no idea that it was foreshadowing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the best they did it in all three was Shaun of the Dead.
Absolutely.
But still, very well done here. Now, take all that away. Take the fact that you've got, like, this terrific, funny film, the last film in this trilogy, a lot of expectations with it, and it pretty much lives up to the expectations. What do you have other than that? Wow, you have a buttload of extra features on this thing. They did not fuck around. I mean, three commentaries. The one to listen to is the cast commentary with Simon Pegg, with Nick Frost and Patty Considine, if you just want to laugh your ass off throughout it. But there's one with Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg. There's one that's a technical commentary with Wright and the director of photography. And then there's picture in picture. There's a 48-minute making of The World's End. There's a thing about the stunts. There's, I mean, just a shit ton of featurettes, a ton of, like, deleted scenes, alternate edits, or not a ton of deleted, one deleted scenes, a lot of alternate edits, outtakes, stuff like that. There's the thing they showed us, the musical mega mix type thing. They kind of put together like a music mix of all three films together. It's pretty fucking cool.
So good. And then of course the trivia track, which was my favorite part of the Shaun of the Dead DVD.
Yeah.
Was it wasn't just like, oh, they filmed here, they filmed there, but it points out like not only references to other zombie movies, but things you should pay attention to. Like, hey, that list of bars that Ed is reading off, that's actually the entirety of what happens the rest of the movie. So I'm really glad that they brought the trivia track back for this one as well.
There's really more than you could watch in an afternoon on the extra features.
Definitely.
Here. So very much worth your time. Now, if you're new to all this and you're just hearing us, or you've never gotten around to buying copies of these things, they've also put out a Cornetto Trilogy Blu-ray with The World's End, Hot Fuzz, and Shaun of the Dead all on one set, which is certainly worth your time as well. All three of these Blu-rays are absolutely fantastic in their own right, have more than enough stuff to keep you happy. Great set to buy. If you don't have these or you only have the DVD edition, whoom, there you go.
Yeah. And I have to say just one more thing about The World's End. This trilogy has meant a lot to me personally. Shaun of the Dead was one of the first movies I saw in college that kind of woke me up to the idea that there was more out there than just what was at my local theater, than the blockbusters, that studios, like, wait a minute, foreign movies are funny? Like, I remember having that realization, like, oh, they're not all dour and, you know, gay cowboys eating pudding and all that.
that was an American film, but all right.
Yeah, well, anyway. But it was just like one of those, it was like, oh, I want to seek out more crazy, you know, lesser known stuff and foreign stuff. And then
Edgar Wright films.
And then Hot Fuzz was actually the first film that Luke and I saw at an Alamo Draft House.
Wow.
True story.
And then by the time World's End came around, you know, I'm sitting in a room interviewing these guys that have really shaped and put all these like stepping stones to where I am now without even knowing it, just by making these films. So it was kind of emotional actually for me to say goodbye to this, you know, this world. I was like, oh, well, That's been a major stepping stone into who I am right now. So,
you know, thanks,
World's End.
The funny thing is, like, even though it's always been referred to as a trilogy, when asked at the Q&A I saw, like, so does this mean y'all aren't going to be working together anymore? And they just laughed and said, no, of course we're doing more movies together. We're, like, all best friends. Yeah there's
I
definitely
more
films.
More
it's,
from them.
Yeah, it's just, like, this was this thematic trilogy of genre stuff that all kind of tied in and out of each other in a sort of underground meta sort of way. That's the end of that series. Yes, there will be more films from this trio.
And it's kind of exciting because you know now they're going to be taking more chances and doing things that are very different. And
Ant-Man. Just saying, Simon Pegg would make a great choice. Just saying.
Just going to throw that out there.
Just going to throw that out there. I'll be the 1 billionth person to say it.
Wait, you didn't come up with that? I thought that was entirely your argument.
No, I'm afraid that wasn't just me.
Weird.
Yeah.
Well, that's The World's End, and definitely pick up that combo pack if you don't own these movies already, which I don't know why you'd be listening to this show if you don't own at least one of them. But anywho, we're going to move on from there to another thing that you probably own at least one of if you are listening to this show, and that is the complete Comps. Doctor Who mega set.
Oh.
You know, all right, so
I don't own any of those.
No, and that's,
I said probably.
That's your fault. I blame you for that, really. It's a failing that you have, Luke Mullen. And we will fix this in someday. But that being said, this is the complete series in terms of since they reinvented it, which is to say from the Doctor who was played by Christopher Eccleston on to the modern day Matt Smith. So it's,
which will further frustrate people trying to come in at the beginning of canon.
Well, that's the thing. You don't really want to start Doctor Who at the beginning of canon, because then you're watching a bunch of really old black and white, really slow stuff with a really old dude as the Doctor. Not the place to start.
I understand that. I've had people tell me that, but you need to understand how OCD I am about starting at the beginning.
I understand.
Of a phenomenon I have no concept of.
They did a terrific job with this series of really making you, explaining everything you needed to know from the beginning of Christopher Eccleston and just going on from there, making it pretty self-contained. When they do pull back old stuff, you get as much information as you need, quite frankly. If you're more interested in that, you can go back and see that older stuff. It is out there, and even more of it now. Apparently, they found a whole load of stuff like they thought that was forever destroyed just recently. But this set is series 1 through 7, which is up through the most recent thing, not including, of course, the episode that just aired, the
Day of the Doctor.
Yeah, Day of the Doctor, but The advantage here is that, first off, this goes through the Eccleston and some of the Tenet series that were never put out on Blu-ray before now, and now is the only way right now, anyway, you can get those on Blu-ray. Previously, just on DVD. Also, you've got like a more compressed version of these sets. Previously, they were kind of in bigger boxes. These are more compressed into smaller boxes, and the quality actually is a little bit better on some of them. There were some unfortunate mistakes in some of them early on. From what I'm told, some of the transfers have been slightly improved with these. All the bonus features from all of these are here as well. And you're also getting the remote control sonic screwdriver, which is the device that the Doctor always used to do pretty much whatever the plot requires him to do at any given moment.
It's Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, pretty much. But except this one will just operate your television set. And not well, to be fair. But it makes all the noises that you're supposed to. You can make lots of cool noises, and it lights up, and I like it.
And funny enough, if you have an Xbox 360 with the voice command and you use the sonic screwdriver to control it, your house explodes.
Now, the odd thing about the set is that it runs at about $300, which isn't, if you take the screwdriver out, which sells for about $100 separately, isn't really a big discount on what you'd normally expect to pay for these. It comes out
individually,
to about $42 a season, which is about normal what these usually sell for new. And that is new. I know most of you, I tend to buy a lot of my stuff used when you get to those high price ranges. I know, I'm a monster. And this, of course, is going to drop in price over time. There's no question of that. There's also the fact that it doesn't have a terribly memorable box. It's just a cheap piece of plastic over a cardboard box that you're going, I don't even know if I should keep this like this or not, which should never be the case for a giant, expensive box set like this. It throws in a couple of extra things, like there's a little tiny little comic book in here and some art cards. Sadly, it's really not enough to justify this price probably a year or two down the road from now. But for someone who's got $300 to spend and really is like, I just started watching Doctor Who and I love it and I want to see everything leading up to this point that's relevant, this actually is a great set. I mean, I'm so glad to have this. And now I have two remote control sonic screwdrivers. I don't even know what to do. Put them in one room, let them fight it out on the same television. Should be fun.
You're a strange lady.
The house will be aflame this time next week.
So, you know, that's the thing. A lot more thought should have gone into this. A lot of this has to do with the fact that the BBC releases yearly the complete whatever. Like last year, they put out seasons 1 through 7 just on DVD. I fully expect by next year there'll be this set, seasons 1 through 9, on Blu-ray out there. So, I don't know. It's one of those, like, this would make a great gift under any Whovian's tree, but at the same time, do you want to get it here? If you already have a lot of the Blu-rays that have already come out, do you want to just wait for them to separately release? Which they certainly will. The Christopher Eccleston and the early Tenet stuff on Blu-ray. Hey, up to you. But I, for one, am happy to have it.
Right on. And we will keep our eye on this price because, as you might have guessed, we will, in the coming weeks, be doing a, I don't know, what to get the geek in your life sort of episode of just all of the best stuff to buy this holiday for all of the geeks on your list.
Certainly.
So we will definitely, if this reduces dramatically in price between now and then, we will let you know. In the meantime, let's talk about Two Guns.
I feel like that's the beginning of the song.
Yeah, I take it that Brian didn't like Two Guns very much.
Let's talk about it because it's on the list.
I enjoyed Two Guns myself.
Yeah, I heard mostly good things. Brian just being curmudgeonly?
It was fine, I guess. I don't know. I was hoping for more. I was hoping that...
Oh, me too.
You know, a movie that had Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington, two guys that I legitimately like and I think can still definitely lead a movie. Plus, Bill Paxton playing an unhinged, sort of second banana type character, which is something he does so fucking well. And not only that, but I actually like the director, Baltazar Komaker.
Komaker.
The Icelandic director. But I don't know. It just came off to me as so white noise. Was just like, okay, that was an action movie.
Denzel Washington is black.
That's true.
Yeah, and so therefore it raises by a star automatically, or you're racist. Period. End of story.
But I just think it can't be white noise.
Why's it got to be white noise? You know, the thing about this film that worked for me is really the chemistry between Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg, which is significant. They work fantastic on screen together. There is literally fireworks at points. The problem is that the plot is kind of stupid. And in fact, expects you to believe a lot of stuff that's pretty goddamn hard to swallow along the way.
Definitely.
There's lots of supporting characters that are should be in it more. Like Edward James Olmos is a crime lord in here. You're like, oh, that's awesome. Let's see more of him. Paula Patton, who chooses to get totally naked for the first time in her career. But...
you said but.
I hate to say there's not enough of her in here, because technically there is.
But.
But I would like to see more of her as an actor. James Marsden is in here. I love James Marsden. Not in here as much as he should be. And like I said, the plot just gets totally ridiculous. Fred Ward! Oh my god, Remo Williams is in this for like 5 minutes.
I mean, it's a mismanagement of its assets. And not only that, but it's got a strong setup in terms of, oh, that would be neat. But then again, even that, if you think about it for 5 seconds, it's like, okay, but wait, what? How would that work? But still, the idea that you have two people who start off the movie as criminals, and that's, you know, going into it, and then it's like, oh, no, they both have a secret, but it's not that they're trying to screw the other one just because they're diabolical criminals.
It's not giving away anything the trailers didn't say about what the secret is.
Yeah, so it turns out, you know, they're both law enforcement. Yeah, they're just thinking...
Neither one of them knows the other one's law enforcement,
and they both think the other one is crooked, and they both think that they're out to help catch the other one.
Which doesn't go on for but so long in the film before they both realize it, but it's a setup for a fun, sort of mismatched buddy cop comedy.
And I agree that the chemistry is really strong between these two. I think the majority of the dialogue between them is a lot of fun, and I was hoping that that would translate to, you know, the action scenes and the story itself. It just felt, in comparison to the dialogue, in comparison to the chemistry between the two leads... there was nothing else really going on.
And
it's like they were relying too much on that to carry the movie.
And that is what carries the movie. And it's so strong that it does kind of carry the movie. I certainly have seen things like this attempt to do this sort of thing. Like Red is an example of a movie that they thought the chemistry was strong enough to carry the whole film when it was not between those characters.
See, I had a lot more fun with Red than I did with this.
Oh, see, not me. I definitely like this a lot better. Maybe it was because there were just too many characters they were trying to balance it out with Red. But, you know, and this is based on just okay comic book from Boom Comics. But when I watched this, I came out of it going, I don't know about the movie, but I would totally love to see these two guys play roles, if not these same roles, and roles a lot like them again in a better written film.
Or even on a TV show, on a well-written, well-constructed TV show where you have these two characters and, like, you know, various heists and various incidents that they get into. I would watch that show.
Showtime, are you listening?
Yeah, I would totally watch that show. Get a couple of great leads with great chemistry.
Paula Patton does a nude scene in every single episode.
Every single episode.
It's
a callback. Or a call front. I don't really care. Just show me something. But yeah, I don't know. I was just kind of meh.
Should have been better, but what there was, I had a fun time with. And I do actually recommend this myself. I just, with reservations.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's funny. I was trying to remember. I watched this movie at the same time that one of the sites I write for was covering some of the special features, and they were releasing things online that weren't actually special features from the Blu-ray. So I had to go back and be like, wait, was that an actual special feature, or is that just something they released online? And the one thing I was going to highlight, I realize now, was just online. It isn't actually on the Blu-ray.
Why would they even do that?
I don't know. It's very weird.
Why would they put a featurette online and not include it on the Blu-ray?
And the featurette was really cool, too. It was all Bill Paxton. It was just Bill Paxton talking about how he's become known for playing these kind of screwball secondary lead characters, and it was so fun.
It's weird to me that there's companies whose whole job it is to arrange and put out bonus features for discs. Like, that's all they do, is do that. And they're all terrible.
None of them are particularly good at their job.
Yeah, like, what? It seems like when the director is directly involved in the process that you actually get good stuff.
Mm.
Oh, well.
So what you actually get here is you get a commentary with Cormacur, and you also get about a 30-minute tour of production and some deleted and extended scenes.
I like the
kind of basic.
Click, click, bang, bang, because that makes me think of a much better movie.
Indeed it does. Indeed it does. Well, that was Two Guns. From there, we're going to slide under the dome.
Yeah. Well, you might consider, like, not... I know it's Brian K. Vaughan, beloved comic book writer of Why the Last Man, amongst other things, Saga recently, and also a contributing writer to the better seasons, later seasons of Lost, who's sort of, he's not the showrunner, but he's close to the showrunner. He's right up there. I know this is based on a big Stephen King book that apparently some people liked. I've not actually read it myself.
And we all know that you saw the Simpsons movie.
Well, this, you know, the Simpsons movie wasn't that good either, so.
That's true. But you're probably familiar with the story because you saw the Simpsons movie.
Look, what you've got here is a small town. Oh, Stephen King, what a surprise. Small town.
Let me guess, is it in Maine?
I don't remember, maybe. I don't remember. I'm sure they said, I just can't remember off the top of my head.
Good start.
It doesn't look like Maine. With that, suddenly this giant invisible dome appears over the whole town and cuts them off completely from the outside world that is completely impenetrable, will destroy and make dangerous any electronic devices you have in your hand if you touch it while, you know, you've got those devices in your hand. For instance, one of the main characters dies in the first episode from his pacemaker by touching the thing.
Oh, shit.
It just explodes in his chest.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
Yeah, that does suck. Every time that my pacemaker has exploded, I was like, well, I guess this future with digital noise will never happen.
Nope, probably not.
I've been saying
that from the beginning, though. So.
And the problem is you've got all these characters. You've got really familiar Stephen King characters. You've got the priest that when it happens starts to go crazy and think that it's God
right.
that's making this happen to punish everyone.
You dick.
Not me, for the record.
I'm doing things off mic that are not nice.
You've got the loner who's come into town involved in a crime thing, but is basically a good guy and has to find his true heart and who he really is starts to come out when he ends up being put in a position where he has to start being looked to help people. You've got the town leader who's corrupt and has multiple skeletons in the closet, played, by the way, by the guy who played Hank from Breaking Bad. Yeah, the only actor in here you'll probably go, I love that guy, and then we'll end up ultimately being somewhat disappointed by. The thing is, this is not a terrible show. It's just 15 years too late to be a good show.
It seemed weird that they were, like, drudging this up now to make a show about it.
Yeah, and originally they were saying miniseries.
I thought Under the Dome was a fairly recent book.
It is a fairly recent book.
Oh, is it? Oh, I thought it was an older book.
No, this came out,
like, two, three years ago.
The idea, but the way it's made feels like a much, much older show.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? Like, all these old techniques, when it's not using the most generic Stephen King tropes, it's using the most generic television tropes. And pretty often, it doesn't help the fact that most of the actors are not all that good here.
Wait a second.
There is a certain conservation of budget that was clearly happening when they cast this. I mean, when you've got, what's his name? Jeff Fahey. Who only agrees to be in your show for like two episodes. Then you obviously were not spending a ton of money.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, the huge actor, Jeff Fahey, we can't afford him.
Under the
for
dome
long.
And clearly under budget.
But even though originally they talked about this being a miniseries, it's clearly now a series because the ending is cliffhanger. Sorry, we're not done yet. And everything feels way too stretched out. Like, does this really have to take as long as it's taking? A lot of characters that don't seem to add up to much. And yet, there's glimmers of hope here and there. This is the mystery itself is interesting. It is involving. And there are some likable characters that run throughout this. I mean, certainly I kept through the whole thing, which is saying something, because usually a show with all these qualities I've described, with all the shit I have to watch, I would have knocked it out of after like six episodes. But I actually did stick with it to the end and found that, okay, not great, but one of those shows that has enough interesting things going, much like the other Stephen King television series, Haven, that I'm like, all right, let's just pay attention for a bit longer and see what happens here. There are moments of this will make you go, wow, that is cool. But there'll be more moments you're like, Jesus Christ, is anything going to happen in this fucking episode? And there's not a lot of huge surprises when it comes to plot arcs. I mean, you can pretty much predict every single character's arc and behavior as you go. And a really kind of distressing story about one character who's the son of kind of the town leader, who's totally rapey as hell. I mean, like, he's like literally kidnaps his girlfriend after she breaks up with him in the first episode and keeps her locked up for like the first three episodes in like a fallout shelter.
Crazy rapey, like Duke LaCrosse.
Demanding that the dome has obviously twisted her mind and that she actually does love him and he'll keep her here till he loves him. And then they go on. After that, she gets freed, and they try and find a way to turn him back into being a more sympathetic character. And you're like, please, stop. Seriously, you have already made it where this character will never be sympathetic. I don't care what you do. Just kill him, make him die in an accident. You make him die heroically. I don't give a fuck. Just
we hate
kill
this
him.
Character. Stop letting him live. Who are you, George R.R. Martin?
Wait a second.
By the way, did you see the thing today where the actor who plays Joffrey says he's going to quit acting after this? He's talking about it, and I was like going, yeah, it just wasn't kind of the fulfilling experience I thought it would be. It's like, yeah, it's probably because everywhere you go, people spit at you.
You asshole. It, clearly, it's you and not the character
yeah,
you play.
Yeah, because Americans and other nationalities cannot tell the difference between fiction and reality.
But that's the thing, though, is like there's a lot of stupid people out there.
That's true.
I mean, hell,
I see them. They're everywhere.
I'm not stupid. I like to think
wait
I'm not.
A second.
And yet, if I saw him like sitting at a restaurant next to me, there would be that moment of anger that would rise in me. You know, you'd know it was fake. It was bad emotion, not real emotion, but you'd feel it.
I would be hard pressed not to lean over as I was leaving and go, Batman should have killed you, and just walk out of the restaurant and be like, that doesn't even make sense.
But Joffrey is not in this series yet. Anyway, there's not a lot of extra features. There's a filming the pilot extra feature. There's a deleted scene, an interview with Stephen King and author Michael Connelly that talk about writing the novel, which apparently they wrote, got halfway through, set it aside and came back 2 years later. Just a bunch of really generic featurettes. Honestly, this is one of those shows, maybe you want to check, I mean, you're a huge Stephen King fan, or the premise sounds interesting to you, and you haven't read the much better graphic novel Girls by the Luna Brothers, then sure, maybe this would be worth checking out for you. On the whole, though, if you're a very avid TV watcher and you're not looking for more stuff to push the list, which is probably gigantic for you like it is for me at this point, you can probably skip it.
Well, Chris appears to be underimpressed with Under the Dome.
I am.
So we're going to move on from there and talk about paranoia, which is what we feel sometimes when we've had a little too much fun with the herbal stuff on Saturday.
Wait, you don't never invite me over on Saturdays.
Well, you're there every time, you just don't remember any of it.
But that's not... Oh, that would explain a lot.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah, paranoia.
Paranoia is the new film from bland filmmaker auteur Robert Luketic.
Oh my god, if you look at this guy's catalog,
probably
it's like,
never made a good film.
Remember The Killers with Ashton Kutcher?
No one does. That's the point.
Yeah.
That was awful.
Remember Monster in Law?
Hey, wait, I liked Legally Blonde.
Yeah, I'll give him Legally Blonde, but The Ugly
Truth.
You
have to go back to his first feature film, okay. Legally Blonde.
Win a Date with Tad Hamilton.
I actually liked 21, for the record. I was the only one, I think, who did, but I did like it.
I didn't see it.
The Ugly Truth.
I'm going off of Paranoia, Killers, The Ugly Truth, Monster-in-Law, Win a Date with Tad Hamilton.
The Ugly Truth is that he's not a very good director.
I mean, Killers is bad enough of a film that alone he should be condemned for the rest of his life for.
And Paranoia is not doing him any favors.
But here he's
starring the lesser Hemsworth.
Yeah, that's the thing.
As a young man caught between competing telecommunications
look,
giants, I suppose, played
Liam,
by Gary Oldman and Harrison Ford.
A Liam in the Hems
bald head.
A Liam, yes, a Liam in the Hems is not Chris Worth in the Bush.
In the Bush.
Yes.
In the Reggie Bush.
That is true. Yeah, so Liam Hemsworth sort of mouth farts his way through this movie, trying to be charming, trying to prove that he can, in fact, be a lead. And unfortunately, he's given nothing to work with. And much the problem that Chris has with Under the Dome, I have a problem with Paranoia feeling like a movie that should have come out 10 years ago, especially since we're supposed to buy that Gary Oldman, who seems like the biggest technophobe in the movie, is the head of this cutting-edge technology business.
Sure.
In fact, like
with his crazy Cockney villain accent.
Well, not only that, but like there's a scene where Liam Hemsworth pitches in something that is clearly the next wave of social media, and he's sitting there going, I don't understand you people, you young people today. I don't understand. I'm like, then how are you still in business?
Yeah.
How are you still a relevant techno company if you are like, I don't get kids. Kids are stupid. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
Wouldn't
like,
the investors immediately like run screaming like rats from a sinking
station? Exactly. It's like, oh, well, this guy's stock should be plummeting any day now that he turns his nose up at social media because he's like, when I was your age, I was developing cell phone technology and no one had cell phones. And I'm like, that's great, Grandpa, but these days cell phones do a lot more than they did in your day, which is to say they do more than be cordless. Like,
now,
come on.
Let me ask you this. Amber Heard is in this. What is her nude scene like?
I don't remember her being
fully... Let me respond by, Amber Heard is in this?
Ah, yeah.
I mean, she's
Amber
maybe
Heard is in a movie
like 10 minutes.
And she's not naked, then something has gone terribly wrong.
I mean, there's a sex scene, but I don't... It's one of those, like... doing like crossfades, and you can't even really tell which part of the skin you're looking at.
Oh, I don't like that.
Yeah, the PG-13 type of sex scene.
So, like, I always think that's like a sex scene that only Cthulhu would like.
Exactly. Right? Just flesh everywhere. Flesh on flesh.
Yeah, it's like
in the dark, we are all the same.
Sex scenes in the Hellraiser version of hell. You're like, I love this part. Look, you have no idea. Is that a boob? Is it a butt cheek? You can't tell.
I don't care. It's an ankle. But I mean, the only even slightly entertaining thing about this movie is how over the top Gary Oldman's feud with Harrison Ford is. They're just so like old school Bond villain at each other. It's ridiculous. It's like, you got where you are by standing on my shoulder. Now I'm standing on your neck.
And yeah,
it's just
like, I will give Oldman at least credit for trying. Ford tries like every third scene.
Yeah.
And when he does, it's pretty interesting. But for the other two out of three scenes, Ford is just like, really, where's my paycheck?
All jokes aside,
where's my trailer?
They must have given him a seriously awesome bag of weed to be.
That's what I was going
to
say. Yeah. All jokes aside,
stoned out of his mind.
I really think this title is called Paranoia because he was stoned all throughout the shoot. Like, I don't know how else to explain it. It tries to be Wall Street. It tries to be that sort of like, ooh, the young people taking down the old crook.
It tries to be antitrust.
Antitrust is such a better movie by comparison, and that should never be a sentence you speak about any film.
I kind of like antitrust.
Oh, it's such a medium movie. It's the flying toasters of movies.
I think antitrust at least has some flavor. This is just bland
toast.
It
really is.
This is toast with no butter.
Even Milka Toast, it's just toast.
The big twist of the movie is like, I'm sorry, that's what everyone was undone by? That? Really? But then you go back to that first scene, you're like, oh yeah, that's because these technology magnates are actually idiots and Luddites when it comes to technology. That's how they can be hoisted on their own petard, and that is why the movie can be hoisted upon its own retard.
I sensed that was coming, and I rooted for it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I am not a fan.
This movie's real bad.
Yeah, it's just,
I can't get over what I saw in the trailers of Harrison Ford with a shaved head. Someone should have known from the beginning, please don't shave Harrison Ford's head. That's terrible.
No, don't do that.
Yeah.
So Richard Dreyfuss is in this movie, and you just kind of want to hug him and
He was in a Piranha remake in the beginning of that. So you're
that,
like,
I'm all for.
But
I love
still,
that throwback.
You know that that means that Dreyfuss ain't got shit going on.
Why? Because I'm a bad guy? I'm scum?
I know. I like it too, but he would never have done that.
I don't even know what I was doing in this movie.
He has nothing.
I don't know. I would like to think that Dreyfuss would do that anyway just for the Jaws connection.
Nah. I don't know what he was doing in this movie either. It's sad. This movie's sad.
He was thinking of a paycheck.
This movie is very sad because you watch and you're like, I think I know what you were trying to do. And by you, I mean every person involved. But you didn't do that.
Well, so give it a pan unless you're too paranoid that they're watching you and expecting you to like it.
They could be. It's hard to say.
Are you paranoid? Are you paranoid enough?
That being said, I do kind of feel like Gary Oldman these days, because Luke got an Xbox 360, and that voice command shit is Skynet.
That. I got an Xbox One.
Oh, I'm sorry, an Xbox One.
Did you? I'm coming over.
Okay. Yeah, oh yeah, then you can come over and watch as the camera follows us from the top of the TV when we move around the room, like fucking Skynet.
I admit that I find that element of it extremely troubling.
It's pretty nifty.
But I still want to kind of see it now.
You can say things like, Xbox, watch TV. Xbox, turn yourself off. What there isn't a voice command for, and why I will never trust the Xbox One,
I do not want to play thermonuclear war.
You cannot say initiate self-destruct sequence to the Xbox One, which means I do not trust it. Skynet. Bum, 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 bum. No, thank you.
How else are you supposed to kill the Klingons after they come for you on board your house?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to move on from there and talk. I don't remember what we were talking about. What we're going to talk about is Dexter, the final season.
Uh-oh,
and I will implore you, Chris, not to spoil anything because I'm still working my way through this show. If you can.
Okay, but I've got to be able to say just my feelings about the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
About the actual end of the show.
Yeah.
It fucking sucked. I'm sorry. Holy shit, what the hell were they thinking? I mean, and the worst part, it almost makes it worse that this is a tolerably entertaining season of Dexter. It's not one of the better seasons. I mean, even, it's better than the worst, not anywhere near as good as the best. It's somewhere in between. And it kind of meanders a bit. There's points you can tell. It feels like when they were writing it, they weren't even completely sure where they wanted this to go. And then when they finally comes time to wrap everything up, it's, you know how there's this whole new type of show, not even new anymore, I mean, really, since The Wire and The Shield, that have anti-heroes as your protagonists.
Sure.
And you go, as a writer, you go, well, what are we going to do here? Because these characters have to be punished in some way, and yet, the audiences don't want to just see them, you know, they don't want to see them get tortured to death or something. You don't want to take them, they're not a villain, they're an anti-hero.
Right.
They cannot get away scot-free, but what's going to happen? That's a hard question as a writer, to be sure. And some shows have pulled it off the answer brilliantly, like Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad,
and
for
The
sure.
Shield found the perfect answer. They do not find the perfect answer on Dexter. It's such a half-assed, like, oh, type of ending. I was like, are you sure that's how you want to finish this up? I mean, they had to have known on set. They had to have known this was a mistake. But I don't know. I mean, the very least I can say about this is you'll have fun at points along the way. There's some weird, weird decisions that are made to do to move some of these characters along. Charlotte Rampling is terrific as criminal psychologist Dr. Evelyn Vogel, who has a very special kind of relationship with Dexter involving his past. Marks the return of Yvonne Stravosky as Hannah McKay, who I thought was a terrific character last season. And it introduces Sean Patrick Flannery as a character in here, you know, from
Boondock Saints.
Boondock Saints.
The other Boondock Saint, the one who's not the guy on Walking Dead.
Yeah, who's has a sort of weird working relationship with Jennifer Carpenter, Deborah Morgan's character on the show. There is enough interesting here, it makes it well worth watching, but I'm just saying, be prepared for an ending that's not going to punch you in the gut. It's not going to make you stand up and be furious. It's just going to make you go, wow, talk about going out with a whimper.
I like the way you danced with the vagaries there. You did a really good job. I don't feel spoiled, but I feel like you definitely got your point across about how you feel about the ending.
Fair enough. And the worst part is,
it's almost like you're a goddamn professional.
The worst part is, there's barely even any extra features on this. It's the last goddamn season of the show.
Yeah, why wouldn't you load this up with extra features?
And nothing. There is, let's see, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 minutes of features. If you don't count bonus episodes of fucking Ray Donovan. Why Showtime always does this, I'll never know.
But wait, bonus episodes of a show that is not the show you bought?
Yeah, no, that's a Showtime's thing. They always throw on, like, episodes of another show that they have so you can check it out and hopefully like that show.
Weird. Yeah. It's like they're trying to wean you onto another drug.
Pretty much. And maybe this is not the season of a show to trust anything else that Showtime does. Even though Ray Donovan is a good show, I'm just saying.
The bridges have been burned a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. I will keep drudging along.
Or bad to know, as the case may be.
I will keep drudging along to get to this ending that is apparently not so satisfying.
Quick question, Brian. How many episodes of Dexter have you watched?
7.
Okay.
7 episodes.
All right.
I will tell you this.
It's more than the 3 I thought you would watch.
You should watch at least through the end of the 4th season, because it's a really good run all the way through there. I mean, there are ups and downs, but the 4th season is, like, spectacular, and it will bring you to the point that you'll be sorely tempted to keep going at the end of the 4th season. I mean, it's, like, the biggest holy fuck punch you in the gut cliffhanger of almost any show I've seen in a long time. And yeah, if you really have to, you can keep going. Season 5 is not terrible, but definitely stop at season 5.
That's good.
Just stop.
Just go ahead and let that one die.
I gotta say, I always wished that, as fun as the first few seasons are, I always wish that they had gone the books route.
Yeah, we're right off the bat.
The books arc for Dokes. Dokes has this accident in the books that doesn't take place in the show the same way. And Dokes turns into, like, this robot, essentially. Like, he has only metal limbs.
Really?
Yeah.
What?
He has, like, claws for hands, and he can't speak. Like, he has, like one of those, like,
Captain
spell
Pike
and speak things.
Yeah, it's like, beep once for yes and twice for no.
Yes, exactly. It's that type of thing. It's insane. It's such a cool thing.
Oh, now you make me want to read the books.
The books are actually
plus,
really good.
I know the big, like, plot changer that happens towards the end of season 6 between Deborah and Dexter happens in the first book.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, okay, from then on, that's an established thing, which I find very interesting that there's a whole series where that's already there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is
crazy. The books are really interesting.
Yeah, I want to read the books. Suddenly RoboCop comes into Dexter. I love it.
Just to say this, and like I'm trying to speak in vagaries, but not the big thing between Dexter and Deborah, but the other thing that's revealed. You know what I'm talking about,
yes,
Luke?
Yes, I do.
That's the dumbest fucking thing in the whole show. And this season, they so dance around it. They're just like, you know what? We're going to mention it briefly just so we don't act as if it never happened and then never discuss it again.
I revel.
Because it was retarded.
Revel in watching nerds talk in code. It's one of my favorite things in the world. Oh, anyway.
Not just one thing, but that other thing.
Let's move on to things that are satisfying, at least I think they are. The To-Do List!
Hooray!
Starring Aubrey Plaza.
I'm so glad
I was going to make an orgasm joke.
you very well could for this one, because there's a lot of orgasms in this movie.
Shadang.
I agree with you completely. This is one of those pleasant little surprises of a modern sex comedy that is genuinely funny as shit.
And it reminded me a lot of the surprise that I got watching, what was it? The A.
Easy A.
Easy A, yeah, I agree with
it's
you.
Like,
except
oh, this...
even dirtier and more...
Yeah,
like,
no.
It's dirtier, it's more... There's more... It's not even cringy, just more like, wow, I can't believe they let this movie come out moments.
I'll be really honest. Yeah. I think part of what works about that, though, is the main character is so innocent about
yeah.
it. You
yeah.
know, like, it really is this, like, journey of sexual discovery, to use, like, crazy art house lingo. But, that, I mean... In all honesty, I think they get away with a lot of the dirtier stuff because she's so oblivious to what it is.
That's true.
I think it's different in the fact that a lot of the sex comedies that are out there are made for a much wider audience in a lot of ways. Even I will go so far as to say it, more of a fratty type of audience.
Totally.
This is kind of a sex comedy for a liberal audience in that way that there's this audience that goes into it like, yes, she absolutely should know more about the world of sex and be open to it and to have new experiences. A blossoming young female here played by Aubrey Plaza from
Here's the fundamental difference between a comedy like this and most sex comedies we get that are male-centric is that nobody's forcing her to do this.
No.
There's no bet. There's no, like, oh, one of us has to lose our virginity by the end of the summer bullshit that you get in, like, American Pie and all those movies. This is literally her going, I am unsatisfied with my knowledge of sex, and I'm going to take charge and do something about it.
Yeah, she spent her whole life being a, you know, a serious student, being very, like, just doing every extracurricular thing, being that straight A's person. And
yeah.
she reaches the point, like kind of watching her older sister, who's kind of a slut herself. Hate to use that term when talking in this review, because it's totally inappropriate, but still, self-described.
Yeah, son, that's true.
Who's like, look, you don't want to go into college without ever having sex. Trust me, you're going to make a huge mistake, because there's a lot of sex ahead of you there from people who will be several steps ahead of you
yeah.
there. So she decides that much as how she's approached schoolwork, she's going to approach sexual education and awakening, which makes for much hilarity.
She actually reminds me, do you remember the character in Mallrats who was like the 15-year-old
writing
girl
the book
oh, yeah.
writing the
yeah.
book? That's who this character reminds me of, like the actual legal age version of that character.
Yeah, agreed. Now, there's a lot of referencing to other funny ribald comedies throughout here that these characters have seen.
Sure.
And that's going to work that much better for you if you've seen all the history of these type of films. But that being said, it doesn't depend on it. It also, this is a period piece comedy. It's the summer of 1993. And while there's over-reliance to some degree of like, remember that?
90s to the
remember
nth
that?
Degree, and I love it.
Remember that? It worked for me. I was like,
I
can see someone who maybe was like in their 60s watching this going, I don't get it.
Yeah, this couldn't be more 90s if Tony, and Tone were producers on it. That's all I'm going to say.
But it does work. Those jokes are actually funny, and
yeah.
they tend not to be just like, look at that, that's a 90s thing. It's like, look at that, it's a 90s thing, and now we're going to come back to it so it actually becomes a funny joke. And I got to say, Aubrey Plaza, she's more than just her simple... role on Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
I still think this is obviously kind of like an early film for her. She was in Safety Not Guaranteed, which she was, I thought showed
movie.
A lot more range there than she did here, but still, she's an actress that has something.
Well, still, she's known for playing characters that are disengaged.
Very deadpan.
And this character is the complete opposite of that. This is a very go-getting character who wants to know as much as possible and who wants to be in the mix. And is at times a little overly enthusiastic.
And wouldn't know sarcasm if it slapped her in
yeah.
the face.
That's true, because it does a couple of times.
Even with sarcasm's penis. Which it
you
does
know, and
a couple
another
times.
Thing I really like about this film is the juxtaposition of her sexual awakening with her parents, like, finding out that their relationship may not have been based on exact truth. I don't nobody really lied to anybody. They just... They just kind of had some misconceptions about things.
And that being said,
and watching them work those out is fantastic.
And those parents
is
being
really
Clark Gregg and Connie Britton was like
the
casting
cast
masterstroke.
Yeah, the cast in this is amazing.
yeah, the cast in this is really incredible. I mean, you have Just smaller turns by, you know, even Christopher Mintz-Plasse. Andy Samberg actually has a really fun small role in this, as does Donald Glover.
Bill Hader.
Bill Hader
is about this.
So good.
Donald Glover's fantastic.
Yeah.
This is a genuinely funny film that got overlooked by a lot of people.
Definitely.
When it initially came out, partially because I think a lot of people weren't watching Parks and Rec, had no idea who Aubrey Plaza was. I suspect there's large parts of this country, theaters took a look at the trailer of this film and said, there's no fucking way we're putting this in a theater in the Midwest.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of parts of the country probably never got to see this.
And it's,
and it's funny because the film's... Well, this started actually as one of the Blacklist scripts. The Blacklist comes out with the top 10 unproduced screenplays every year.
Yeah.
And its original title was The Hand Job.
Yeah.
And actually, the only reason that they ended up changing it was because they were having trouble getting locations permits because everyone thought they were shooting a porn. So it was like, we'll have to change.
Who watches porn films just about hand jobs?
I
always say, like... Your girl gives you a hand job, you're like, that's adorable. Let me show you how it's done.
It's like going to a steakhouse just for the appetizers.
That's like going to a restaurant that only makes like cheap ramen noodles and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. You're like, I'm pretty sure I got this one covered.
Dude, I'm dieting right now and that sounds like the most fucking delicious thing ever. Can we ton of both of those?
Sometimes you just need the simple things in life, is all I'm gonna say.
What did I tell you? Walking embodiment of meat and potatoes, Luke Mullen.
Right here.
I'm just saying.
Although, if a girl can actually fondle his meat and potatoes, that would be really great.
If a human being...
I like steak as much as the next guy. You want a PB&J.
If a human being...
You want it to give you an HJ.
And I want it to give me an HJ.
If a human being could be a chain restaurant... Golden Corral, ladies and gentlemen.
It's funny because it's true.
It's really fitting, actually. What were we talking about? Food? I'm hungry. Jesus Christ.
Man, anyway, the to-do list is good and you should watch it.
Totally.
Absolutely. Highly recommend it.
That is 100% in agreement from all of the people you hear talking. Moving on, we're going to talk about AbFab Complete.
You know, what? I know I'm a dude. And I've got a penis.
Ostensibly.
And so, ostensibly. I can prove it on camera, I'm just not going to.
Well, we don't have a camera, so that would be awkward.
Yeah, it would be awkward.
It's even harder to prove it on the radio.
Even if we did, all right, hold on.
Wait, what is that?
That was my
penis. Why does it have a claw?
Yeah, well...
It's looking at me!
There's a lot of things that you need to know about that are not entirely dissimilar from the plot of The World's End.
What language is it speaking?
Dickies? Anyway, Absolutely Fabulous was a very popular British sitcom created by Jennifer Saunders, based on an original idea by her and Dawn French, who also plays the other main character. They're the two main characters. They're older women who are very shallow, who just pretty much shopping is the whole goal of their life, who live in England. And Jennifer Saunders has a daughter who's kind of always baffled, who's very smart herself and always kind of baffled by the shallowness of her mother and her best friend, played by Dawn French once again. It was one of those series that every girl I knew in the 90s was like watching. Every woman I knew was like, God damn, like having those points at a bar where they'd find a corner and talk about AbFab the way I used to with my friends talk about Lost. Huh. Just like really excited. Oh my God, did you see that? That was so funny. Okay. I took me a while before I got a chance to see it. And I did. And I went, I kind of felt about it the same way I did about Sex and the City. This is not bad. This is very well done. It's very well acted. There's some very funny parts in it. I'm never going to sit down and really be like, yay, I can hardly wait to watch the new episode of Absolutely Fabulous. It's just not made for dudes, period. And this new complete set, which also includes the more... They recently came back and did new episodes. It's been one of those shows they take breaks for like 5 years and then come back and do new episodes. This, I think, was like a 10-year break or something. Like a long break between this with new installments. And that's on here along with some special features they put together. And the whole thing is in like a box that's supposed to look like a purple clutch purse, which is appropriate considering these girls are fashion... I don't want to say whores, but mavens?
You're on your own, buddy. This is like Redford mavens. And All Is Lost.
Yeah. It's actually a very funny show, but once again, it's not really for heterosexual dudes. It's nice the BBC are finally putting out this complete collection together. I suspect we may have just seen the last of Absolutely Fabulous we're going to see. Quite frankly, they're both getting pretty old. Oh, sorry, my cat has turned into Katniss Eversneeze. He's got a cold. But yeah, this is it's there's some bonus features on here. There's not a lot here, but what's nice about this is it can be hard to track down all these separate sets, and it's kind of nice to get them all in one big set together. Sadly, just on DVD, not on Blu-ray, but then again, you don't watch a show like this filmed like a single camera sitcom and go, man, I wish the digital quality of this was much higher, because I would love to see the details on that dress. Or at least I don't, anyway. So
I like Sex and the City. That is what I have to say.
Love it.
So. You love Sex and the City?
Yeah, love it.
Yeah,
really?
I think it's a fantastic series.
I think it's a very well-made series. I just don't think it's for dudes.
I am a dude, and I love it.
Okay, fair enough. It's for girls and Luke Mullen.
And Brian Salisbury.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, dude, I'm in the shit a weird world here
the
today.
The thing that really bothered me about the Sex and the City movie...
No, I'm not saying it's not a great show. It is a great show. It's just, well, it made some shitty movies, but it's...
Well, but I really like the first one, but I'm all alone in that.
See, that's where I can't agree with you, because that completely undoes the... wonderfully poignant, perfectly fitting ending that the show had, and it was like, oh, never mind, because this movie wants to make more money. Fuck that. Anywho.
Yeah.
What were we talking about?
We were talking about AppFab, Patsy and Adina. I do really enjoy them. When I watch one of these episodes, I laugh all the way through. I just don't feel it grips me enough to pull me back and watch another episode. But if you have a female friend you want to get something really nice for, that they're going to love you for forever, that tends to likes BBC stuff at all or quirky comedy, they are going to love this series, and you should totally hook them up with it. Or alternately, Luke Mullen. So
there you go.
True story.
Well, from there, we're going to talk about the latest Blu-ray release, the 30th anniversary, I believe, of Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Yeah. Hi-yo. I don't know if I've ever actually seen this.
Really?
Not.
What?
I don't know. It's likely, but it didn't stick with me, I guess.
I have a VHS copy of this in French.
Yep. Yep, that is
why
entirely
why would you own that?
Because he speaks French.
Because I speak French.
But why specifically in French? Do you think it was more beautiful in its French version?
No, it was fun to have because we could watch it in class.
Donde está la bibliothèque, Mickey?
Yes, Mickey, you're speaking Spanish. But
is that Spanish?
That's Spanish, yeah.
I don't even know anymore.
I don't know where the library is. Right. But
voulez-vous coucher avec moi?
I don't want to sleep with you, no.
Was that what that means?
Yeah. Wait a second.
That explains a lot about gay guys hitting on me at that bar.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll get back to that in a minute.
Mickey's Christmas Carol is really great.
Much like Luke, I had a VHS copy. In fact, I had two VHS copies of this. This is one of the first... This was the movie that taught me why you don't open the second movie if you get duplicates. Hmm. Because I remember I got this for Christmas at home, went to grandmother's house, one of my relatives got it for me again. I was probably like six. And so I had two copies, and I remember my mom was talking on the phone. I'm going through all the presents when we got home, and I'm like, well, I already have it. But I kind of like the idea of them right next to each other on the shelf. So I opened it and put it on the shelf next to my other one. And my mom was like, now we can't take it back. And I was like, oh, so don't do that. And that is a lesson that has stuck with me ever since. If you get duplicates of something, don't fucking open the second one.
You weren't the brightest child, were you?
I was six. Come on. Come on, man.
Also, who cares if you couldn't take it back? Did they look good next to each other on the
shelf? They did. They totally did.
Who gives a shit?
I knew that's what you would care about.
Okay. This has nothing to do with you being a child, but... Damn.
What?
You have a unique and beautiful mind, Luke Mullen.
I like you too. I can't believe you haven't fucking seen Mickey's Christmas Carol, though.
I probably did. I just don't remember.
Do you really want to mess with Luke's head? Next time you're at the house, just slightly turn the pile of Blu-rays on top of the shelf, like cattywampus.
Oh, yeah.
You'll go insane.
No. I have friends just like Luke as well that I have lots of experience with doing that thing where you go, you know what one of their favorite movies to watch is. You take it and you move it. One place out of place.
Motherfuckers.
Drive them insane.
There's a special circle of hell for people.
They'll stare at it for an hour before they see where it is because they can think is, why isn't it where it's supposed to be?
Well, Mickey's Christmas Carol is actually one that I watch almost every year and have since I was a kid. It's your favorite Disney characters inhabiting the story, obviously, of the Christmas Carol, with Mickey being Bob Cratchit. And Scrooge McDuck being Ebenezer Scrooge. That might have been a tad too easy. A tad on the bill. But you also have Goofy as Jacob Marley and Donald Duck as Scrooge's nephew. But I mean...
Jiminy Cricket?
Jiminy Cricket is the Ghost of Christmas Past. The Ghost of Christmas Present is the giant from the Disney Jack and the Beanstalk.
Wait, Ghost of Christmas Future is the relevant question.
The Ghost of Christmas Future, they actually keep cloaked for most of it. And then he's revealed to be... From like
it's
the early
Bluto, right?
It's Walt Disney's frozen head.
You know, it's weird. Like in the early days of Disney, they had this sort of like Bluto from Popeye type character that was a dog. And that is kind of who they bring back to be the Ghost of Christmas Future. It actually works really well. But I enjoy this a lot. It's schmaltzy, of course, but I like the way that, especially the backgrounds are animated. They did a great job with creating these sort of very rich Dickensian type backgrounds on which to then, you know, animate all of the characters. And I think, now I've read a lot of negative reviews about the picture quality on this. I actually think it looks really good.
I will say the most unnecessary use of the word Dickensian ever.
Oh, well, I used it.
I'll use any opportunity. I'm at, like, Hot Topic. I'm like, it's Dickensian, and it's, no, it's not.
And they're like, sir, you're going to buy that Twilight hoodie, or you're just going to stare at it all day, and then Chris leaves. But yeah, I think it's actually really fun. And this is the same thing that I ran into with Sword in the Stone, when everyone was just raving about how terrible, you know, that transfer was.
It wasn't.
I didn't think it was bad at all.
No, it wasn't bad at all.
I find a lot of charm in seeing the pencil lines of the old style of animation, of the Cell style of animation that we don't get anymore because everything's done on computers.
I mean, I saw that and I went, it's not as good as some of their primary releases, but who the fuck is complaining? It still looks better than it ever has.
And I thought this looked better than Sword in the Stone, and yet I'm reading reviews and I'm like, wow, you guys are really just nitpicking the shit out of these Disney releases. I mean, I think it's, and it's a really short movie too. It's only like 23 minutes. I mean, it's more of a, like a TV show episode, but it's great to add to your Christmas rotation. If there are things that you just kind of put on in the background while you're decorating the tree or while you're opening presents, whatever it might be, we actually have a pretty standard rotation, at the house that includes things like Die Hard and actually Jingle All the Way.
You're goddamn right it does.
Rare exports,
sure. Yeah, but I like to add this in, you know, the shorter mix of things like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Frosty and Mickey's Christmas Carol. I actually put this in the same category, not just because they're both Christmas carols, but in terms of how much I enjoy them and how much it's fun to watch on Christmas, as the Muppet Christmas Carol.
We should totally do a cross Christmas Day Orphans Christmas this year.
Oh, yeah.
Where we spend like half the day at one of our houses, then everyone walks over and sings Christmas carols the whole way to the next person's house since we're a block away
from each other. Yeah, we live a block away from each other. We can totally
and do the
caroling.
Other. There's like a different selection of movies and food at each house.
I like Chris, that idea.
We don't like you.
Oh, wait.
Spend time with you
I'm sorry. Okay. It's the Sex and the City comment, isn't it?
No, it's just in general. We don't like you.
I suspected this was the case. I just never knew for sure until...
It's because you haven't seen Mickey's Christmas Carol.
This show just imploded on itself. That's incredible. But yeah, I really like Mickey's Christmas Carol. I think...
It's a black Christmas. Thank you very much.
Oh my God.
That sucks.
Can we talk about the paradox of the fact that Bob Clark directed A Christmas Story and Black Christmas?
I should clarify that the remake sucks. The original is obviously brilliant.
Yeah, the remake of Black
that
Christmas
sounded
is,
weird.
Is dog shit, but obviously the original
is
great.
Amazing.
Anywho, Mickey's Christmas Carol is not Black Christmas.
It's not?
No.
I meant more to say that I will be crying myself to sleep on Christmas Day thanks to Luke's offhand comment.
Oh, sure. That's
okay.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, that was the intended result.
To be fair, we actually love Chris.
There we go. It's on record. Mm. We can't take it back. But yeah, so in terms of special features on this, it has that really fun thing that we've seen a lot lately in Disney Blu-rays of the intermission. Whenever you pause it, it's not just a frozen screen.
Yeah.
They actually start doing like Disney sing-alongs of a bunch of Christmas songs.
Yeah, that being said, every time I go, okay, I'm going to go to the bathroom and pause it and walk off.
And then
I'm
you're
just
really
there,
interested in the pause
and it,
screen.
And it suddenly starts going playing and I'm like, oh shit, what the fuck is that?
Who's in my house? Who's caroling in my house?
Stop Paranormal Activity!
And the other thing this features is some bonus shorts, one of which is brand new, which I was surprised to see. Like, I wasn't surprised so much to see the classic shorts with Donald Duck and Pluto and Goofy, but there's a brand new one. It's very strange, where they've kind of done Minnie and Mickey in, like, German cuckoo clock-looking characters, and it's about yodeling. And I was like, oh, well, this is not only bizarre in and of itself, but to add it amongst all of these classic shorts was just... an unusual thing to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I will say, the short that precedes Frozen, which is sort of a new, old-style Disney short, is phenomenal.
Oh,
so
okay.
I hazard that it has to do with them kind of going back to the well a little bit and trying out the classic Mickey style again. But yeah, overall, I think if you know Mickey's Christmas Carol, then you already know that you love it, and you already know that owning it on Blu-ray is a really great thing. And I would... ignore the naysayers, personally. Like, I don't say that a lot, but I think there is way too much cynicism about... And I think what it comes from is the fact that Disney has done such a tremendous job taking its catalog and making it look so breathtaking that anytime it falls short of that, I think there are people who just pounce on it. And I don't think this looks bad at all. I don't think it looks as good as, you know, like Sleeping Beauty or some of their other just A-list transfers, but it is not a bad transfer at all. I think it looks really good.
Now, I got to ask, because I know Luke is the technical guy, and he loves this as much as you do. What do you think about the transfer?
Actually, I haven't had a chance to watch this one. I was reading over the Blu-ray.com review, and it seems like what people are upset about is the post-processing, where they'll apply, you know, digital sharpening and things of that nature to try and either mask issues that they feel were present in the source material or just make it look a little cleaner. And, I mean, the thing about that is that it can be problematic, but it's strictly, it's very subjective, you know, it's going to come down to each person's personal preference by and large, especially with an animated title like this. I mean, generally, post-processing like that, like on something like the original Predator Blu-ray, is a big problem because then Jesse Ventura looks like a plastic doll.
True.
But, I mean, something like animation, like the effect is going to be a lot more subtle, and I can understand if it's the type of thing that rubs you the wrong way, but I think for most people watching it, it's probably not going to be a big deal.
And I don't think it's objectively a black mark against the Blu-ray, whereas something like digital noise reduction that makes characters look like plastic dolls.
Kind of a problem.
Yeah, kind of a problem.
Why are we named after that, then?
Because digital noise reduction is the problem. Oh. We are the digital noise.
Okay, fair enough.
Boom. There title explained, because that's always more fun when you explain the joke. Anywho, we're moving on from there.
I get it. It's funny now.
Hey, hey, hey. Hilarity. Family Tree Season 1. What the hell is this?
Oh, boy. I actually love this show so much more than the British do, which I find to be very funny, because this came out on the BBC channel, BBC Two.
Are you one-upping the British on their own product?
No, it's weird, because it was originally came out on there, and then HBO put it out as well, but it was kind of marketed towards the British, because they thought they'd get it more, and this is a documentary-style television comedy created by Christopher Guest, which is to say, do you know all Christopher Guest's movie comedies? He gets a TV series, and this is it. If you like those television comedies, like Best in Show and
For Your Consideration, Waiting for Guffman,
yeah, then you're going to like Family Tree, because it's fucking funny. And this one takes Chris O'Dowd, who has lately become a personal favorite of mine in comedy. I think he's a genuinely funny guy. Lets him do his own fucking accent for
Hooray!
Once. As a young guy who's basically decides that he's going to investigate his family tree, his lineage, and figure it out. And he travels all over England. He goes for a large portion of the series to America and investigates there. It's got your typical cast of Christopher Guest, like people you want to see, you know, Michael McKean, Christopher Guest himself, who's one of the funniest characters in here, Ed Begley Jr., Kevin Pollak, Bob Balaban.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, Fred Willard. A lot of these people you expect to see in these things who are, as usual, really, really funny in this, as this guy goes through this experience, finding out that nothing he thought he knew about his family is actually true. And again, going down like roads to find out, wow, I think we were Native Americans, or I thought we were theater actors, or I thought we were these, only to find out that certain things were not, there was a missing piece of evidence, and things did not actually happen the way he thought they did.
Huh.
And that sort of feeling of like, oh, well, I guess I'll try and absorb myself in this culture as sort of an outsider, because it's who we are, only to find out, oh, wait, no, that's not really what happened. Because he finds out that a lot of his family were a bunch of philandering, bunch of kind of douchebags in the past.
Don't you hate it when that
happens? Were fooling around on each other, and nobody was whose child they really thought they were, and it ends up being pretty goddamn funny show. Now, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea or cup of coffee if you're people watching on HBO instead of the BBC. If you like these type of Christopher Guest movies, you know who you are. This is going to please you. I guarantee you're going to like this show. If you've seen these films, even the best of them, which is still, to me, best of show. I don't count Spinal Tap, because it has such a different feel from the rest of the Christopher Guest films.
Mm.
But you're going, if you don't like those films, if you don't like Best in Show, this is going to do nothing for you either. It's kind of dry. Its humor is kind of cringy humor, where you're like, that's really awkward and uncomfortable. But Chris O'Dowd lends a lot to this in the lead role here as Tom Chadwick. He's just so utterly likable and kind of hapless, but not stupid. You know, he just wants to find out who he is. And it is a story about a guy who just doesn't know who he is in his own life, so he's investigating his own you know, genetic background.
Sure.
Try and get some ideas of what that is. He's one of the funniest things about this is Nina Conti, who plays his sister, who had a traumatic experience with when she was a kid. They're never really entirely clear, but there was a traumatic experience with a puffin, and so now she uses a hand puppet of a monkey to communicate her true feelings, which often says really embarrassing, awful shit to people along the way, and she can't help it because she's truly mentally deranged.
It's like Lamb Chop.
Yeah, I suppose.
We don't know that Sherry Lewis isn't deranged. That's all I'm going to say.
I will agree with that.
I'm going to get a t-shirt made that says that.
But this is a totally solid show. I really do. I highly recommend it. It made me laugh all the way through. I couldn't put it down.
Right on.
Nice.
I'm going to have to check this out. I like Chris O'Dowd. I like Christopher Guest. I like people named Chris.
Aww.
And you as well.
Ow.
So from there, we're going to talk about the Criterion release of this week, and that is City Lights, the Charlie Chaplin film from 1931.
What a fantastic film.
Often referred to as his best film. In fact, the AFI have listed it as the number one romantic comedy film of all time.
I can see why they would rank it so highly. Like, I haven't seen as much Charlie Chaplin as I've seen Buster Keaton, but this was by far the best of the Charlie Chaplin stuff that I've seen. I absolutely fell in love with this movie.
I love Chaplin and I love this movie, but it's hard for me to call this absolutely my favorite because, boy, there are so many contenders. He's made a lot of great movies.
Absolutely.
Modern Times is probably the one that most blew me away from Charlie Chaplin, where I was like, wow, that has got some incredible sequences in it. But this is still just like has so many great points to it, has this great story about rich and poor and the way we look at people being endemic to like who we are, and just this his relationship is he's the classic tramp, you know, the poor hobo,
the last who has time a he heart would play of gold.
Well, he played the character again, but not as the tramp specifically. He would, like, play it in reference to it
Of
thing, you know? It was, like, little bits where they're like, ah, that's supposed to be the tramp. He falls in love with a blind girl and ends up developing this weird relationship with a totally drunken millionaire guy. Whenever he's drunk, he's like, you're my best friend. And whenever he's sober, he can't remember him at all.
And that, of course, is the movie's biggest commentary about social class systems. Yeah. It's like this millionaire who gets drunk and loves the tramp and like, let's be friends, let's go here and there. And then when he sobers up, he's like, get this worthless hobo out of my house.
Which still has, you know, take away the social commentary, take away all that. Really funny movie.
It's just funny to watch.
There's a boxing scene in here where he's forced to do a boxing match to try and get money to do an operation to help this blind girl. And it's so brilliantly choreographed. You can see why Jackie Chan is a big Charlie Chaplin fan. Oh,
the way he matched, it was incredible. Chaplin matching the movements of the referee so he stays out of his opponent's eye line.
Yeah.
It's a dance. I mean, yeah, I don't know really how else to describe it. It's beautiful. It's so well done.
And then they'll switch and he'll like kind of go off to the side and no one else will notice. And so his opponent and the referee will then be dancing around each other. And it's really, really impressively done. And there's just kind of a very basic sequence early on where Chaplin's looking at something in a mirror and like kind of backing up and going forward. And, like, a trap door opens up behind him, and just the exact choreography, like...
And how dangerous
Take away the fact that it's a silent film, and they could easily have been cueing him, like... I mean, they had to have been cueing him off-screen, but, I mean, the cues are perfect, because not only are they cueing him, but there's, like, a deadlift thing going up and down on the trap door, and there are moments where, literally, like, he's already stepped back... And it's just now rising into perfect position just as he steps down.
I don't know how he didn't kill himself. I mean,
it's amazing.
It seems like a simple thing, just moving back and forth. But when you think about all the moving parts and the fact that he is trusting whoever is guiding him and his own timing because he's not looking back at all.
Yeah.
And at any point, that thing could not be there and it would be the end of him.
And this is a perfect example of why Chaplin was considered to be such a genius. Not only just timing sequences like that, perfect choreography, pitch perfect sense of heartwarming to social commentary to never being treacly about any of that stuff at all to just flat out funny stuff.
Yeah.
But the fact this was like 4 years after the open advent of spoken word film of like films with sound, and everyone was like, this is a terrible idea. You cannot put out a silent film now. Everybody wants this. And it was a monster hit.
And it's funny because Chaplin weaves in little criticisms of talkie pictures or just little jabs against it. Like, there's a scene early on where a bunch of people are giving speeches at a microphone. And even though Chaplin has this whole score going throughout the movie to kind of keep things light and keep the story moving, he stops the score to have just kazoos when the people are talking at the microphone. And it sounds so tinny and weird. And then you realize that at the time, that's exactly how actors in sound pictures sound. It was kind of tinny because microphone technology was still developing. And it's basically him just going, yeah, this is what sound pictures sound like to me. So there you go.
But it's funny to me because then he goes on to use sound effects to great whatever.
Slide whistles and
slide whistle in particular. You know, is such a great sequence.
And the boxing bell plays such a, like,
there's a
part where the rope for the bell gets attached to him. So he goes to his corner, it rings, he goes back to fight, and then he gets knocked down, and it rings again. So he doesn't know it's attached to him, so he keeps going to the corner and into the ring and getting knocked down, and it's hysterical.
It's laugh out loud funny repeatedly through that entire boxing sequence. I mean, there's a reason why many people call this the greatest silent film ever made. A lot of people do, and certainly a lot of people have referred to it as the greatest romantic comedy ever made. I don't know if I'm going to go that far with the greatest romantic comedy, but it is one of the best silent films I've ever seen.
I will say that the ending of this film is so poignant and so perfectly executed and just so uplifting that I was in tears. Like, this is the first silent film I've ever seen that's made me cry. And it was just so gorgeous.
Not even when you were watching porn with the sound down so your wife couldn't hear you?
Well, I was masturbating with those tears.
Yeah, it's a different kind of crying.
Yeah, it's a different type of crying. But yeah, I was so in awe of it. I was like, this is everything that classic cinema should be. And this is everything I want to see when I stumble across. And I feel like it almost makes me angry with myself that I haven't been watching this my entire life.
Right. I hear you. Exactly. Yeah. Like those points when you're younger and you're like, man, I love film. I love film. Hey, do you want to watch a classic? I'm just going to rewatch Back to the Future.
Yeah, like an idiot.
Which, not necessarily like an idiot. You're rewatching Back to the Future, that's which is true. But, you know what I'm saying. It's like, totally. It's easier to go back to the things you already love than it is to, like, go back and try something that seems, maybe it's going to be a little intimidating, hard to get to. City Lights is not hard to get into. You're going to like it almost from the get-go. And hey, more good news, fans. This is Criterion putting out, which means, wow, there's a lot of bonus features if you fall in love with this. Mm-hmm. Original trailers, a documentary focusing on Chaplin's career and legacy, a featurette that from a visual effects expert who discusses Chaplin's methods, which is important because actually Chaplin did a lot of stuff with visual effects, archival footage, there's lots of deleted scenes.
They have home movies. They had one of Chaplin's friends would just film while he was, setting up shots or doing this or that. So you have these 80-year-old home movies of Charlie Chaplin as a special feature. It was incredible.
I mean, like I said, there's at least one thing in here that's a whole nother comic routine that was totally left out of the film completely, probably for time. But, this is fantastic. Commentary by Chaplin's biographer and a full booklet, a really good booklet, illustrated booklet by critic Gary Giddens and with a 1966 interview with Charlie Chaplin. This is one of those Criterion sets that's about that is the very definition of why people venerate Criterion editions.
This is one of my favorite releases they've ever put out. Yeah. Not just for the movie. The transfer looks, I mean, if you consider how old this movie is and what they had to work with, it looks so good. And the sound, even though, again, I mean, you're talking about an 80-year-old movie and a monorail track, as they call it, like, it still sounds incredible. And then all of these special features you get with these very intimate behind-the-scenes moments, just decades and decades old. And
it's filled with wind.
And the artwork on the front is just perfect. I love this release. Love it. I think if you have never seen a Chaplin movie, not only is this the one I think you should watch, this is the release you should pick up.
Absolutely.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
City Lights. All right. I've gushed enough about City Lights.
It's pretty good.
It is pretty good. So why don't we talk about Tank Girl?
I'm so mad that you got this and I didn't.
From City Lights...
And you may very well hate Tank Girl. Most people hated Tank Girl, but...
Oh, I know you love it. I could tell from frame one you would love this movie.
I really like Tank Girl, and I know this is not a good movie. I get it that it's not, but I've been quoting this movie ever since it came out. I mean, like in the dumbest ways, ways that don't even make sense. How many times I spend hours of my day looking for an opportunity to say, not if we play Monopoly, because I kick ass at Monopoly, but I get to be the shoe, which makes no sense at all. But it made me laugh like crazy when this movie came out. This goofy, completely not true at all to the comic book created by Jamie Hewlett and Alan Martin. Hewlett, of course, is one of the guy they got to do all the character stuff for the band, the Gorillaz. You know, the original comic book is a lot of fun, but this for me, Lori Petty, I was so in love with Lori Petty before this even came out. It just, it makes no sense, this whole film, but in the most glorious, absurd way. There's weird cameos by people like Malcolm McDowell, Naomi Watts, Iggy Pop, Ann Cusack. I just had fun with how just dumb fun this thing is. It's so quotable, and I'm so pleased to know that despite the fact that it was like had almost universally bad reviews when it came out, it's now officially considered to be a cult film.
Well, as like, I'm watching this movie,
Mark Savlov is the other guy, the local critic.
Not surprised to hear that either.
He and I are both like, every time we get together, we're like, oh, Tank Girl's awesome.
Not surprised to hear that either. This is the kind of movie from frame one. I kept thinking, this is going to stroke Chris's niche until he gets his punk rocks off.
Yeah.
Because that's all this movie is a punk rock comic book come to life.
Yep.
And I didn't hate it. I enjoyed Lori Petty's
character. It's very Repo Man-ish.
I enjoyed the production design especially, and just like the weird sort of punk rock Mad Max post-apocalyptic future.
Yeah.
And obviously when you've got you know, Naomi Watts, Malcolm McDowell, and Ice-T as a supporting cast. And not only that, but Stan Winston doing these effects to make people look like half man, half like dog mutant.
And such a great soundtrack.
Of course.
Oh my god, it's got a great soundtrack.
It's, yeah. I mean, it's exactly the type of movie that if you have ever been wholeheartedly into punk rock, especially in the 80s and 90s, like...
And not even punk, but like, accessible punk.
I think it's a little more accessible than Repo Man.
It's not like rough punk. Like, Repo Man's more like sort of rough edge punk. This was more that sort of later period of like the beginnings of like pop radio getting into punk. And the soundtrack is people like Portishead and people like that, you know, and Bjork and just, it's really good. I don't know what to tell you. I like it. I'm so mad they didn't send me this. I sent an actually very distressed email today off the Shout Factory going, what the hell is this? You didn't even tell me you were putting this out.
Well, Chris's ranting aside.
Yes.
It's a very enjoyable movie.
Production designed by Catherine Hardwick.
Are you shitting me?
That's what it says.
Catherine Hardwick. Okay, that's interesting.
Maybe she should have stuck to production design.
Yeah, her and Tim Burton. But, I mean, this is a really fun movie. Like Chris said, it's not a good movie. I mean, it's not the kind of movie you're going to look at and go, well, I can see why this is a classic, and it has to do with all of its academic substance and blah. No, it's a very silly movie, and it does bring this comic book to life in a way that you'll enjoy or you really won't. And I think it just kind of... I think it comes down to your tolerance for even the most accessible punk rock. And I had fun with it. I wasn't bowled over by it. I think this is a really good release, though. I mean, the transfer is great.
Is this the first time you've seen it?
It's the first time I've ever seen it, yeah.
Okay.
And again, I love all the creature effects that Stan Winston does to create, like, Ice-T and his little, like, mutant army. I think that's legitimately great.
And it will be disappointing to people who come in as fans of the comic book expecting to see a representation of the comic. It's totally schizophrenic. It's like one of those, like, I mean, you read about the making of this, and it's like, they had no fucking clue what they were doing, and they were making it up day to day. Well, that was true of Apocalypse Now, too. Not to compare this of Apocalypse Now, but nonetheless, it's not a very good representation of what the comic
book strategy,
was.
Though, does lead to Lori Petty looking like she's having a blast playing the character, which is always something you need in a movie like this. And I will say, the schizophrenic nature of the filming and of the movie plays into this this interview that they have with Lori Petty on here, where they're literally just asking her about the most random shit they can think of. Like, hey, you did an episode of Freddy's Nightmares. What was that like? You did, and this will bring you back to Digital Noise Past. They ask her about doing the TV movie Bates Motel.
Oh, no kidding.
They're like, what was that like? She's like, yeah, Bud Cort and blah, 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 and talking about all this stuff. And I'm like, holy shit, we're probably the only podcast that has ever talked about that movie at any point for any length of time. And here it is in this special. And they're just like throwing, like, what was this like? What was that like? It's clearly a fan interviewing her and her just not giving a fuck about structure or anything. It's just like, yeah, I want to talk about this. I want to talk about this.
So I guess I was hoping you'd hate it because I'd be like,
I didn't hate it.
I'll trade you for something.
I could still trade you for something. I didn't love it.
All right, we'll have to look through the catalog.
All right, fair enough. But yeah, if you're a fan of Tank Girl, obviously this is the best release out there. If you think it might be a movie that would interest you, it probably will. And you should definitely pick up the Shout Factory Blu-ray.
It's goofy, and it's neon, and it's ridiculous. It's just so freaking absurd all the way through. It just, like I said, I can't emphasize enough how great the soundtrack is to this. And I just had a shit ton of fun with it. It makes no sense. I mean, there's even points like, I love the animated sequences in this. They're so cool. But the reason they even exist is because literally they forgot to film sequences. I mean, that was how disorganized the production was. They were like, oh shit, we totally forgot
scene
to
be
film
filled
that
in later.
Scene. So they had people come in and animate them. I was like, okay. But you know what? Happy accidents all over the place that turned into a fun mess.
Indeed. And moving on from there, I am, oh my God, I am Austin Stoker to talk about this next release from Shout Factory, which is Assault on Precinct 13. Oh my God, you guys, Assault on Precinct 13. Oh my God, it's so good.
Another one I didn't get sent that I had to send an angry missive off about. Go, dude. Why do I not have Assault on Precinct 13?
Dude, this is... Okay, so if you're not familiar with Assault on Precinct 13, it is John Carpenter's... It's his first theatrically released movie. So this predates Halloween, and it is about a police station that comes under fire. It's basically what's happening is that Austin Stoker plays Ethan Bishop, who's this cop that's been assigned to Precinct 13, which is actually moving. So his job is really a babysitting job to kind of watch over the precinct as they're packing everything up and moving to the new station house. Well, in the meantime, a local father, his daughter is murdered by a gang, and he goes after one of the gang leaders and kills him, which prompts the rest of this, essentially four gangs that have united, to come after him, and he seeks shelter in the precinct. And from there, it's a siege movie. It's absolutely, it's Siege on Precinct 13. It is Rio Bravo remade for the 70s. It is phenomenal. It is a low-budget classic that everybody needs to see.
Now, I have seen this. I saw it right after I saw the remake, which is the first time I went back. I was like, you know what? That remake was very dissatisfying.
All John Carpenter remakes.
I've got to see the original one. Sure enough, the original's pretty fucking awesome.
You know, it's so hard to remake John Carpenter that even he can't do it.
True.
Because he remade Assault on Precinct 13 as Ghosts of Mars, and it sucked.
It sucked big.
That's how hard it is to remake a John Carpenter film. So there's so many great things to love about this movie. First of all is an actor named Darwin Jostin, who plays sort of the anti-hero of this movie. He's not really the bad guy. He's one of the convicts. There's a prison bus that's transporting people, and they end up stopping at this precinct, of course, as all hell is breaking loose. And he plays Napoleon Wilson, who is kind of like the baddest convict on that bus. And the interplay between him and Austin Stoker's character is just so great, because at any moment you think that Napoleon's just going to like turn the tables and try to escape. You think Austin's just going to shoot him and be done with him. But like that's such a great character dynamic the whole way through. And this is a great example of something that would typify Carpenter's movies from here on out, which is how he uses stillness. I think I've talked about this a number of times before, but he was really good at creating an eeriness in just something standing still. I mean, you see it in Halloween when Mike Myers is just standing. Standing on the lawn across the street. He's not doing anything. He's just standing there. And it's creepy as hell. He does the same thing here with these gang members. These gang members hardly ever talk. There's hardly a word spoken by any of them. And yet they present this such like almost zombie-like presence where they all just move together uniformly. They're fully animate, but they don't seem to have like full cognitive powers. And they're just coming in through windows and like breaking in. And it really feels like a zombie movie at points. And that's something I think he does so well, and something we will see again later in his future films. I have so much fun with this movie. The dialogue is really sharp. He does a great job making the ghettos of LA look like a post-apocalyptic landscape. Like, he uses these really wide angles to kind of show cars moving through empty lots and desolate buildings. And this isn't a third world country. This is LA in the 70s.
Kind of a third world country.
Pushing third world country status.
But the real question here is, why is the Shout Factory edition make it special?
Because of everything we've talked about on this list so far of releases this week, I honestly think this has the best transfer. I think this is the best of any of the transfers that we've talked about so far. This movie, what Shout has done on this, the only word to describe it, in my opinion, is pristine.
Wow.
Like every inch of every shot. And they don't go to such extremes that they eliminate every ounce of grain.
Yeah.
But the grain there is almost imperceptible. And when you do see it, it's like a warm blanket. It's like, oh, I am still watching a film that was made in the late 70s that was shot on 35. I don't feel like I'm losing anything by having this Blu-ray transfer of it. And it is just, gorgeous. Like, I loved it so much. And there's a great interview with Austin Stoker on here. There's, of course, original artwork that you get with all of the, with almost all of these Scream Factory releases. And you can switch it out for something more like the original poster or the original artwork. They have an interview with Nancy Loomis, who turns up in several of Carpenter's films, including Halloween and The Fog. I think this is going to have to be my pick of the week. Not just because it's a movie that I really love, but it's the best this film has ever looked. They went all out on it, and I am so happy that they did. And Shout Factory, if you're listening to this, whatever deal you struck with the devil to end up with the rights to so many Carpenter films, keep them coming.
For the record, I'm still going with City Lights as my pick of the week.
No, and that's fine. And that's a very, very close second
choice. Yeah.
Very close second for me. But this is, you know, shortly after Halloween sort of broke the horror movie barrier for me as a little kid, my dad, sensing that I might be into John Carpenter at a very young age, was like, okay, sit down, we're going to watch this movie. And it was Assault on Precinct 13.
I've got to meet your dad.
He's here in town.
I know. I've got you need to bring your dad over here. We're going to have a scotch.
Okay, cool.
Because I have a feeling your dad likes booze from what I've been told.
Yes, indeed.
And I've got some booze.
You do,
as
indeed.
It turns out.
A little bit.
Yeah. So maybe tomorrow night.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, bring him over. Let's come over, watch a movie.
And drink some booze. Drink some booze. Actually, he's going to be on.
Not you, of course.
No, just him. My dad is actually, here's a little preview of the week's content. My dad's going to be on Inside the Locker with us, talking about sports.
I like it.
Generally having a good time. So
even though it strikes me he was never a guy who would have been inside the locker. He was more like outside on the playing field.
He was, actually. Yeah. He lettered in three different sports, but he was also into like Dungeons and Dragons and... Like, my dad is the anti, like, classify him at all.
He's the guy from Zero Charisma who was the cool geek.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. He's more of the hipster geek in Zero Charisma than he is Sam Eitzen. But once again, pick up this movie. I don't care if you've never heard of this movie. Go out and buy the Shout Factory release, and you will thank me later.
Fair enough. Now, I believe we have one, or you should say two more films directly connected to talk about that I have not seen.
What?
I can't even get a phone call back from Blue Underground.
Luke, we have to... Okay, so Chris has never seen... Have you seen at least the first one?
No, I've seen the first one. I liked it a lot.
Luke, Chris has never seen Maniac Cop 2. We must correct this immediately.
The Zadar calls to him.
I have been called to the Zadar, and I understand. I'm willing to take this one on the chin.
This is a joke in reference to the fact that the star of the Maniac Cop movies is Robert Zadar, who has the biggest face in cinema.
Seriously.
It is a catcher's mitt with eyes.
Like, it's like watching if the guy from Mask got a career in action and horror films.
It really does kind of look like Rocky Dennis. But Maniac Cop was a movie directed by William Lustig, who also directed Maniac. The guy really likes the word maniac. I don't know what's like.
It's a good word.
But the basic storyline of the first one is that there was this cop who was wrongfully convicted of basically peddling drugs. He goes to jail, and to cover up the conspiracy, he's murdered in his prison cell. But wouldn't you know it, he comes back as sort of this zombie law enforcement who doesn't care who's innocent, doesn't care who's guilty. He's just caring about revenge.
As you do.
As you do. And the first one, what makes it so great is you have this lineup of, you know, just great 80s-era actors. You have Bruce Campbell is in it. You have Tom Atkins is in it. You have Richard Roundtree is in it. William Smith is in it. Like, all of these people that you recognize from these great films of the 80s. Now, Maniac Cop 2, obviously with sequels, there is a...
They're often not as good.
Yeah, there's a tendency to think, well, it's a sequel, it's not going to be as good. There's two things you need to understand here. One is that William Lustig and Larry Cohen, who wrote pretty much all these movies... Both are on here again and come back for this. And the other thing to recognize is that the stunt work in Maniac Cop 2 is in and of itself worth the price of admission. They are doing things in this movie that at the time no one had ever done. I will give you an example. Hey, I know we've got this guy who's been on fire for about 10 minutes, but it would be really cool if we could also drop him out of a 3-story window while he's on fire. And they fucking do it.
Now, Bruce Campbell's back again for this one,
Bruce
too,
Campbell
right?
is back. I don't want to give away too much, but he's not in the movie very much.
Oh, that's a shame.
He's not really... They introduce a new hero in this movie played by Robert Davi, who is fantastic as this sort of Mickey Spillane, hard-boiled detective who just doesn't give a shit anymore, and they keep trying to get him evaluated by the police psychologist.
Well, that's so nice, because that guy always plays, like, third heavies in films.
No, he is...
In The Sopranos, and he's, like, the guy from the bad guy from The Goonies.
Exactly, you know? Yeah, he's one of the Fratellis from The Goonies, but in this movie, he is just not taking any shit from anybody. He is the cop. They keep trying to make him know the psychologist, like, I don't believe in this bullshit, and all this other stuff, and he's just hard-boiled to the nth degree, and he comes up against Matt Cordell, who's come back from the dead again, and this time he's teamed up with a serial killer who is going around strangling strippers, and the two, like, Matt Cordell, the maniac cop, and this serial killer become friends. It's this weird sort of, like, buddy-villain movie for
a
little while.
That's really strange. Wait, he's an undead cop.
Yeah.
Who has teamed up with the not-dead serial killer.
Right.
What's their reasoning as to how these two, were they were at a coffee shop?
Well, he becomes in a, the serial killer becomes
an online chat room.
Right. Like, how do they end up, you know, being strangers in the night? But yeah, so he teams up with them because he's just such in awe of his work. And Cordell teams up with the serial killer because it's like, I'm still on this quest for revenge. That's all I care about.
I need some help.
And so the second one is really about the stunt work. And one of the things that you will notice is that I think there is a police station, and it's funny that we talk about this right after Assault on Precinct 13. There is a siege on a police station in this movie that I think rivals the one in Terminator.
Okay, that's pretty strong words.
He, like, Cordell is just walking through walls and shattering them and throwing police, like, through these barriers, and shotguns are going off everywhere, and it is just, like, it is eye candy for people that are action hounds. And, man, this movie is so good that you, for a moment, you're like, you know, I think this might be better than the first one.
Really?
Yeah.
And all right, so now you're telling me I really need to seek this out.
You really need
liked,
to see.
I liked the first one a lot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Then you will definitely like this.
Okay.
One.
All right. Fair.
Definitely. In fact, there's a great sort of documentary about the film called "Back on the Beat," where they talk to William Lustig. They talk to practically the entire cast. And Robert Zadar, you're a great guy. You're a great actor in this. But he looks like someone who ate shellfish.
No.
Who shouldn't have eaten shellfish now.
He should have been, at this point, a leading role in one of the big baseball films, just playing the glove.
Just playing the glove, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but anymore, he's looking rough these days. But they talk about it. They talk about how, you know, how it was conceived and the way they were coming up with it. And it's so much fun to listen to. Bless you, monkey.
I'm sorry, Katniss ever sneezed.
Poor guy. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, and there's an audio commentary with Lustig and Nicholas Winding Refn,
Wait, really?
Because Refn is writing the remake. Maniac Cop remake.
You know, if you've seen Nicholas Winding Refn's films, you go, like, this is a guy who's very experimental, he's very violent, such things, but you don't think of him as a guy who just sits around and venerating Maniac Cop.
But he is such a fan of exploitation. That was, you know, and again, I'm not trying to name drop, but when I got to interview him, we were like, yeah, this movie, great that you're working on. Let's talk about Maniac Cop. And we just kept going back and forth about what we love about the original and about the second Maniac Cop.
So good to have Cargill back on the show.
Right? I know. I hate to name drop, but I was just so excited. Like, oh my God, let's talk about Maniac Cop. I never get to talk about Maniac Cop. And there's, you know, this transfer looks great. This is a movie that so many people have forgotten about. There's really, to most people, no reason it should be on Blu-ray. But, you know, in association, you know, with Blue Underground has done such a great job. Now, first of all, Blue Underground, if you don't know, is owned by William Lustig. It was started as William Lustig was such a fan of these Italian horror movies, and he got so sick and tired of not being able to get good copies of them, good transfers of them in the States, that he just formed a company to go buy the rights to all of them.
I wonder what that's like, speaks horror film critic who can't get on Blue Underground's list, William Lustig.
Start your own. Wait, no, that won't work. But yeah, Maniac Cop 2, it looks great, it sounds great, it is such a wonderful follow-up to the first one, and in many ways actually trumps the first one.
That's crazy.
And you're going to have a blast with it.
Now, I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark here and say Maniac Cop 3 probably is not as good as the first two films.
It's not.
From Blue Underground here.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it looks better than it has any right to. It still has some fun moments.
It's still directed by William Lustig.
It's a very, I won't say early because he was in the Bad News Bears, but it was still a very early in the career role for Jackie Earle Haley at the beginning of the film.
Wow.
And showing up is one of, like, the only person I thought was missing from any of the Maniac Cop movies with all of their encompassing 80s actors, Bliss, was Robert Forster. and he shows up in Maniac Cop 3, and it made me so happy. I mean, yeah, there's some fun to be gleaned from it, and again, it looks better.
Oh, yeah, Paul Gleason, too.
Come on.
The principal, or not the principal, the guy who was in charge of detention in the Breakfast Club.
Yep, you mess with a bull, you get the horns.
Yep.
Maniac Cop 3 Badge of Silence is, like I said, it's a lot of fun. It still looks better than it has any right to. It's the unrated version? I don't really know. I don't really know what was cut out initially.
Yeah, like, you sure this got a theatrical release?
I can't say for sure it didn't. But, I mean, even still, they have a making-of documentary. They have deleted and extended scenes. They even have on both of these movies. Now, here's the crazy thing. Blue Underground blew my mind with this one. They have these coded for D-Box. If you happen to have motion sensors...
Wait, seriously?
Yeah, if you happen to, in your home, which you can buy... the D-Box motion sensor on your chair, this movie matches up with it, as does Maniac Cop 2.
That's like... You know what? I'm telling you right now, if you own a D-Box chair, first off, can we be friends?
Yeah, let's be
friends.
Because
you obviously have a lot of money, and I'd like to be your friend. and you're a huge movie geek, and right there.
Totally.
And two... Like, this is, you know, this is that one that proves that you're not just buying your Pacific Rims and what have you. You're like, hey, man, I'm getting the cool shit here. I'm going to go back. I'm going to, like, sort through all the shit and go, hey, check it out. Maniac Cop. And look, if you don't own this already, I'm judging you. I'm judging you. It's that simple.
Fair enough.
Awesome. Well, actually, our giveaway this week is related to these releases.
Wait. Continue.
Okay.
I would feel better if that was a beer.
Yeah, right?
God, at this point, Red Bull's all I can deal with.
This is really funny. We actually have, and this is a very limited release, they have re-released on CD the soundtrack to Maniac Cop 2. There are only 1,000 of these that are printed.
Oddly, it also has Portishead and Bjork in it.
It's weird, right?
No, it doesn't.
And this soundtrack, first of all, has a theme song, sort of the Matt Cordell theme, that's this weird disembodied whistling that's really eerie, and I think one of the better, like, 80s horror themes, you know, of any slasher movie. And that's, you know, all that stuff is on here, and at the end, this is so brilliant, the Maniac Cop rap.
Seriously?
That is a thing. Now, if you remember, this movie came, Maniac Cop 2 came out in 1990. And if you remember, all throughout the 90s, there was this horrifying trend of rappers appearing on horror movie soundtracks. Master P is on the Scream 2 soundtrack. I'm just going to throw that out there.
That is true. Yes.
And I think MC Hammer shows up in both of the Addams Family movie soundtracks, I think.
Yes.
So, yeah, this was something that just happened. And William Lustig tells this great story. And it's on the documentary here, where he's just like, I came out in the office one day and saw all these... I don't know why he's Stan Lee, but for the purposes
sure,
of this,
works,
he's Stan
yeah.
Lee. I came
better.
Out into the office one day and saw all these black guys just sitting there, and I thought, we should do a rap song on the soundtrack. And I was like, really? You saw black guys and thought rap music? That is the story that you're telling.
Excelsior.
Right? Excelsior. Slightly racist Excelsior.
Brian only has like 6 impressions. He just rotates them.
Yeah,
really
it's
well.
True. It's really kind of sad.
It's funny. Like, yeah, it is that thing. It's like, it's contextual, really. You think it is. Did you know that most chocolate vodka is actually just vanilla vodka?
I did not know
for
that.
For the record.
Racist.
No, I'm just saying. It's not. They just vanilla vodka. They put chocolate on. In your brain, you think, chocolate.
And then Robert Zadar comes in, and he sounds like Patrick Warburton. I don't know why. Anyway. But we have the Maniac Cop 2 soundtrack.
Sorry, totally abstract thing yeah. going on this side. I apologize. Yes. You should want the Maniac Cop 2 soundtrack, because Brian Salisbury says it's great. Does Luke Mullen say it's great?
I say it's great.
He says it's great. What else do you need to know? It's a Maniac Cop 2 soundtrack. It's got a pretty impressive little CD cover going on here. How many of your friends are going to own the Maniac Cop 2 soundtrack? Not many.
Not that more than 1,000.
That makes you special.
Yeah.
You should try to get this from Digital Noise. And you know what? We're going to help you out with that.
And you know what? I'm not going to change the script on you very much. I'm basically just going to push you a little further into one of the directions. Because as you know, what we've been doing with these giveaways is sort of a creative writing prompt. Well, now I'm going to give you a chance to be as concise as you possibly can, because here's what I want you to do. Now, as you remember, you will have to be following @oneofusnet on Twitter in order to win. I'm going to give you the opportunity to tweet your entry at us.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes. So here's what I want you to do.
So glad you're in charge of this.
I want you to come up with the worst possible pairing of rapper to horror movie, and I want you to tweet it @oneofusnet with the hashtag horror rap.
Does it have to be existing
no.
Robert Harford? Because that would still leave a huge yeah. amount of possible slashers.
I would prefer it if it wasn't existing,
okay,
in
so
fact.
One you would go like, wow, this would be really, truly bad.
Like, if you were like, yeah, I think that if they had gotten Chris Cross to do
Dead Man Walking.
To do, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, or Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. Just come up with the craziest thing you can think of. We will choose our favorite, and that person...
R. Kelly to Evil Dead 2.
Ah! trapped in the cellar.
Busta Rhymes to Halloween Resurrection. Wait a minute.
I'm just singing the pissing in the face thing.
So. Trapped in the cellar. I'm going to go ahead and stay in the cellar. So, yeah. So, tweet at one of us net the worst possible pairing of rap star to horror movie soundtrack that you can think of, and hashtag it horror rap. And we will pick our favorite one, and that person will be contacted via Twitter, and you will win. Again, guys, this is a limited edition. They're only doing 1,000 of these.
It might be worth something.
And you hold on to it for a couple years, you never know.
Not necessarily a couple years. Horror fans are ridiculously culty and geeky about paying top price for stuff like this.
Yeah.
I mean, having been to a lot of conventions, I can tell you right now, stuff like this, I see for like... going for like $100, $150 all the time.
William Lustig came to the Alamo Drafthouse for a double feature of Maniac and Maniac Cop 2, and that bitch sold out.
Yeah.
So there is definitely a cult following for this movie, for this franchise. And again, we have the soundtrack of Maniac Cop 2. Just tweet at oneofus.net, the worst possible pairing you can think of rap star to horror movie soundtrack, hashtag that horror rap, and we will pick our favorite. That person will win.
All right, let me just say this. I'm sorry this was a longer than usual episode of the show, but I was so glad to be back.
It's nice to have you back.
I had a great time over on the other side of the world, but quite frankly, I missed just sitting around with my best friends and talking about movies.
Yeah, and we do want to thank Richard Whitaker from the Austin Chronicle for filling in. The guy had a blast doing it. Nothing. Don't worry about it. Just earmuffs. He did a great job, and you know, we were really happy to have him.
What's going on?
I hope we get to work with
him again
sometime.
Don't worry about it, buddy.
Okay.
Right. Well, that's Digital Noise for this week.
Yeah, a hell of a week for movies, and we've got more coming up for you in the future. We've got more giveaways. We've got more awesomeness. There's so many big things coming up in just the immediate future that you're going to want to stay tuned.
Yeah, we're going to have a holiday gift guide. We're going to probably do a show that's just about our favorite movies this year.
Please stay tuned. Please tell your friends about us. Check us out on Twitter. I'm at Chris Cox Critic.
At Bry Guy Salisbury.
At LD Mullen.
And you can follow this show at Digi Noisecast. Hey, we're even on Tumblr now. We have a
Weird.
Tumblr account.
I don't know what that is.
Even I didn't know that.
I only use Tumblr for porn, so I'm confused.
Well, can you use Tumblr for porn?
We need to talk.
I mean, still images.
Oh, fair enough. That's not, yeah.
You know, I think I've gone all the way around on porn where, like, you know, it's like the increasing, like, you have to have more to stimulate you. I think I've gone all the way around the corner now where I'm back at still images.
Sometimes all you need is Phoebe Cates stepping out of the swimming pool.
Oh, such a great moment.
Yep.
That is a true story. But if you're interested in that, that is oneofusnet.tumblr.com. And you can also follow this show individually on Facebook. And I swear to God, one of these days, I'm going to remember exactly what that address is. But it is facebook.com/digitalnoise.oneofus. So
there you go.
There's so many ways that you can get in touch with us. And we want to thank you for submitting questions to the Letterbox and for tweeting at us and, you know, just... generally being fans.
Now, I'm just going to say, this is my favorite day of the week when we get to record this show.
Yay!
I love it. I'm so happy you're hearing me at top form, and I apologize that that's as bad as it is.
Remember, buy stuff from our Amazon links, even if it's not the stuff we talk about. Consider becoming a subscriber. On the right-hand side, you'll see that we have a place where you can become a subscriber, giving $1 to $25 a month, or making a one-time donation. If you do a monthly donation, you can cancel it at any time. We really do appreciate it. It helps us keep the lights on. And yeah, I guess that's going to do it. And for Luke and for Chris and myself, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. And remember to stuff your eyeballs as much as you stuff your face.
I'm trying to picture someone putting turkey in their eyeballs.
It's delicious.